Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Talk about online abuse now. And if you're online, maybe you've experienced this yourself and it's prompted you to stop reading the comments or block comments altogether. This weekend, though, there's an initiative that is going much further than that. It's a protest against the steady stream of racist abuse online aimed at black and brown soccer players in the UK. For 4 days, everyone connected with the world of professional English football, that's what we call soccer over here, has agreed to boycott all social media platforms. That's everyone, including players and coaches at the highest Premier League level, owners, clubs, journalists, and the Premier League itself. None of them are expected to post or tweet a thing. And this during a full weekend schedule of games in England. We wanted to hear more about this, so we called Musa Okwanga. He is an author, a journalist, and host of the Stadio podcast, who covers professional soccer in England and elsewhere. Musa Okwanga, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Real pleasure. Thank you.
Would you walk us through the types of messages that professional soccer players of color are getting on social media on a regular basis? And here's where I'm going to say that the language here might get a bit rough. It might not be for everybody, but this is what people are dealing with. So get ready.
Sure. So there are roughly two categories. The one category, which is actually the use of emoji. So whenever players make a mistake on the field or just on the field excelling or having a good time on Instagram, monkey emojis will appear beneath their profiles, and this happens endlessly to a lot of people. The other thing is the repeated use of the word throughout matches, after games, whenever a player is excelling, whenever a player misses a big chance, you'll see that word everywhere.
So whether people are winning or losing,
yes,
they're still abused.
Absolutely. It's the visibility. Professor Ben Carrington, who covers the overlap of sport, football, social issues, talks about this. He says that actually for some football fans or racists who watch football, they use this racist epithet as a form of social sanction, a bit like a kind of digital whip. So when you see a black player excelling on the field or enjoying themselves off the field, you send them that to put them in their place.
A prominent player named Kyle Walker recently shared some of the racist abuse that he's received, and then he added a question aimed at the likes of Facebook and Twitter saying, when is it going to stop? So have any of the social media companies said or done anything to address this?
Not really, no. And the interesting thing about this boycott, and it's funny because when I first heard of the boycott, I must admit I was a bit skeptical, right? But then I came around to it because what I think it does is, very interestingly, when major athletes, and this is not just footballers boycotting, it's netball stars and cricket stars and Formula One drivers, when celebrities leave social media, they disempower those platforms. They remove their legitimacy.
You know, it's interesting that there was the women's sports writers, you may be aware of this, back in 2016, the women's sports writers and women in sports media in the United States made a similar effort. They asked male friends of theirs to read some of the tweets directed at them, right. And they videoed it and put it up online, and then they couldn't do it. Some of the men was like, I can't do it. So I'm just wondering, I know this isn't an expert in this,
fine.
But I'm just interested in what's your take on, like, why? What is it about sport that encourages this kind of behavior, you think?
I think, that's a great question. There's a lot of things going on here. So I think, first of all, when you see someone like LeBron James or Megan Rapinoe do something amazing on the field of sport, we say they have sporting intelligence because it's regarded as something lesser. So athletes already, whatever they do on the field, they're regarded as a lesser form of professional character, right? So when people watch sport, generally, we're encouraged to view athletes as they're acting off instinct and they're there for our entertainment. So there's also an element of ownership, right? So when you look at an athlete performing for you, you're like, well, whatever they're doing is lesser because they're regarded as a lesser form of the species, even if they're like, you know, multimillionaires. So if we take that context of ownership and the context of, let's say, racism in America, where you've had black people who were owned until a few generations ago, you have a situation where people are like, well, actually, they're kind of ours. We're used to them performing for our benefit, so we can say what we like to them. and we look at the patriarchy in, you know, all across the world, and the way that women are viewed as almost the property of a lot of men, and a lot of men, because it's generally speaking men online that send this abuse to women and to black people, that sense of entitlement is already bad. But when you're behind a screen, the safety of a computer screen from hundreds of kilometers away is magnified. It's magnified, if that makes sense.
It does. And it does. I do want to point out that racism isn't a new problem for English soccer.
Not.
And it's not just online. I mean, there have been cases of players using racist slurs on the field, referees using racist slurs on the field, fans being thrown out for doing things like throwing bananas at a black player. Has the Premier League done anything to address this?
It has. It's taken steps. It's banned players before. They banned Luis Suarez for an incident of racism against a fellow player, the Liverpool player against Manchester United. In some cases, they've banned people from football grounds for life. So they have taken some steps, but there's still more these companies can do. If you're making the kind of profits that these, or turnover that these companies are making, you can afford to employ more people to address online racism.
You know, there are people who I know will be listening to our conversation. They'll be like, so what? You know, it's just words. It's
course.
Just emojis. You know, so what? You know, block it. Block it. Don't look at it. So what? Just what? Why does this matter?
Well, I think when people say that, if people are going, so what? I'm thinking, do you actually like women? Do you actually like black people? Like, no, that's my serious question, because I'm like, well, if you had a friend that came home and said, I got rape threats at work today, oh, go in the other room. You wouldn't say that. Why is it acceptable then for footballers to receive rape threats in their place of work? It's not acceptable. Do you actually care about the person being abused? Have you actually listened to the pain it causes them? So I'm almost asking them to go a step further and interrogate their own motives for wanting to turn away from it. Because as we know, not only in America, but in Europe, people are very quick to avoid difficult conversations about racism and sexism and the rest of it.
That was Musa Okwanga, an author, journalist, and podcast host covering England's Premier League. We're talking about the boycott this weekend of social media from all players, all individuals connected with English soccer. Musa Okwanga, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Since you're my special friend, come closer for a special treat. I'm going to let you touch me in a special place.
It's never okay to touch someone else's private parts. Your mom and dad will tell you so.
Known as Boys Town, it spanned the globe, counting over 400,000 members who exchanged images of child abuse, especially of boys. Now, after months of investigation involving cooperation with police forces across Europe, the US, Canada, and Australia, four German men have been arrested in raids, including one in Paraguay. Our correspondent in Berlin, Damian McGuinness, told me more.
It's the largest known platform for child pornography that the authorities have ever come across. It's being also seen as a major step forward in the fight against child pornography. This was an international investigation, and these four suspects had been tracked down in April. So three of them have been under arrest since April. They are three German nationals living in Germany. Two of them are accused of administering this huge website. And a fourth man, also a German citizen, also accused of running the site itself, is in Latin America. And he is now under an international arrest warrant. So police have tracked him down as well. So the homes of these four men have been searched. The evidence has been found. And the evidence is chilling, because what we're seeing here is, as you say, 400,000 people worldwide have been exchanging the most shocking child pornographic material, including videos, images of extremely young children. And that's why this is obviously being taken incredibly seriously by police. The last large website that was known like this was a couple of years ago, also run out of Germany. There we were talking about 100,000 users. That was shocking. This is a whole new level, almost 500,000 people. And that's why the site has been shut down and the investigation is carrying on, because I think what the authorities here are saying, and the signal of this, is that anyone who's involved in sharing or looking at this sort of material is not, it cannot, will now be hunted down. That's what officials are now saying, because this cannot be allowed to continue.
And briefly, this is an extremely complex investigation involving police forces from all over the world.
Yes, that's right. So you have police forces from Canada, from Australia, from the US, from Germany, and also users from all over the world. And that's why it's so complicated. But I think what we've seen here is an incredible level of international cooperation, which does show that child pornography can be fought. And that's the one positive thing that's coming out of this whole story.
Damian McGuinness.
This the city of Chicago.
For more than a year, investigators for the Park District have been looking into allegations of widespread serious sexual misconduct involving lifeguards at the city's pools and beaches. WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos broke this story today, and he's here to talk about it, and a warning that we will be discussing sexual assault in this conversation. Dan, you got your hands on confidential reports from the Inspector General for the Park District to its top officials and board members. What do they say about how this investigation started?
So, Melba, this has been going on now for more than a year, completely hidden from the public. It all began with two whistleblower letters early last year. The first was to Michael Kelly, who's the Park District's CEO and superintendent, and the second was to Mayor Lori Lightfoot's office a month after that first complaint to the Park District. Then both were forwarded to the Inspector General, and the whistleblowers alleged, quote, horrifying stories of sexual harassment, sexual assault, even rape. One said she herself was sexually assaulted at age 17, but that managers at the Park District disregarded her comments, so she didn't file a formal report in a toxic work environment.
That appears to have launched the investigation. And now, more than a year later, the investigators say it's not merely allegations we're talking about here. Their review has corroborated several serious, potentially criminal allegations.
That's right, Melba. The Inspector General says they've been able to find evidence backing up accusations against three lifeguards who were in their 20s. In the worst case, they believe what happened was likely criminal, that a senior lifeguard forced a then 16-year-old girl to perform a sex act while he was giving her a ride home from work at North Avenue Beach. And the report says he tried to rape her and then threaten her when she told a coworker. Another was accused of groping and assaulting women in locker rooms at two pools on the northwest side. And a third lifeguard was accused by the Inspector General of the Park District of being a, quote, manipulative serial sexual harasser who abused his power at the Park District to mistreat his own subordinates. Now, he denies the allegation. The other two men have left the Park District, and one of those two also told me last week that he denies the allegations.
Dan, obviously at this stage in the investigation, there's still a lot that we don't know. What are we hearing from the mayor and the Park District officials?
Well, they're not saying much at all. They're saying that they're limited by this being an ongoing investigation. Mayor Lightfoot's office kicked it over to the Park District. The board president at the Park District, Avis Lavelle, did not return messages. And there are a whole litany of questions that the Park District spokesman would not answer from us, including what's the scope of this? How many lifeguards? How many supervisors? How many victims are involved in this investigation? Have they referred this matter to law enforcement? And why has it taken so long? They didn't respond to any of these questions that we posed to them.
Dan, what do we know about what happens next?
The Inspector General said these three reports were just the first in a series on specific incidents, and then they'll look at systemic problems, make some suggestions for reform. The Park District says they won't talk until the report is complete, and nobody knows how long that might be.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Melba.
That's WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos. You can read Dan's investigation at wbez.org/lifeguards, and you can share your story confidentially by emailing investigations@wbez.org.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me, and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. What started last summer as a debate over whether Rockwood schools should be open has descended into schoolyard bullying. But it's the adults who are fighting each other. And the level of anger and insults being hurled has caused at least two educators to walk away from the district. St. Louis Public Radio's Ryan Delaney reports.
Politics didn't used to enter the schools. The school plays and Friday night football games were where parents could put politics aside. don the school colors, and root for their kids. But without those common things to bring it together, the Rockwood School District community is pulling apart. Angela Mernon says despite political differences in the West St. Louis County school system of 22,000 students, parents like Mernon always agreed on school. Until this year.
It just always felt like school was sort of the sacred place, no matter what was going on. And we've been able to just coexist all these years and come to mutual agreements. And now everything's just, it's just gotten so nasty.
Many parents were furious when the district decided last summer to start the school year virtually. They took to Facebook to organize opposition. Parent Shamia Reese says it started a fire.
And then all of these little fires jumped off, and now we have a wildfire.
Many of those fires are over how, or even if, diversity should be taught in classrooms. But a fight over the thin blue line patch on a baseball uniform provided plenty of kindling and wound up in the news.
Developing in Rockwood this morning, the Eureka High School baseball team will no longer have the blue line flag on its hats.
And parents pushed back. In mid-March, after Superintendent Mark Miles' decision to not allow the baseball team to wear the patch supporting law enforcement, he received dozens of emails, many laced with vulgar insults. Parents said he was disrespecting law enforcement and pandering to liberals. "Get a backbone and grow a set. You're an embarrassment," one said. "You are a disgrace," another parent wrote. Miles has been called a lot of things this year, and after just 2 years leading the district, he is retiring from the position and public education. Parents have been similarly upset over a district curriculum they say is indoctrinating their children in what they call Marxist ideology. One parent accused the district's diversity coordinator of being racist toward white people. They've also been upset over students being assigned books with black main characters. A few weeks ago, a district literacy coordinator sent an email to teachers. It suggested they not share the reading lists with parents to avoid complaints. The email was later posted online and drew national attention.
One official urged principals to hide the online materials being used in class.
The district issued an apology. The administrator's personal phone number was later posted in a parent Facebook group. St. Louis Public Radio was shown hundreds of screenshots of posts in the secretive, concerned parents of the Rockwood School District Facebook group that circulated the leaked email. The group has also been used to support conservative school board candidates and taunt and bully district administrators. No parent who actively comments in the group would agree to an interview. We asked a dozen of them. But one, Janet Diedrich, told Fox News the diversity lessons upset her.
"Why are you doing that? That belongs in a college anthropology course to me." So I started looking through the book, and I was shocked at what I saw.
In a post to the Facebook group, she called the administrator an arrogant idiot for trying to turn kids into, quote, social justice warriors. Angel Bastida Salazar, who has a six-year-old daughter in Rockwood, says she's worried attacks by some parents will scare teachers into not talking about diversity in a district that's 75% white.
"I'm afraid that we're going to go back to a place where I'm going to feel like, okay, we're in the 50s again."
And the debate's still raging. Last Friday, 200 people filled an event space near Eureka for a panel discussion with two Republican state senators to discuss whether systemic racism should be taught in school.
"Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me in the back?"
Parents on both sides of the argument attended and argued. And after some booing and shouting outbursts, from the back of the room, parent Crystal Domogowski took the microphone and with an emotional crackle in her voice, defended what she wants her daughters to be taught.
"Because I have raised my kids to love people and to accept people no matter what. And just because I do not want critical race theory taught to my children in school does not mean that I'm a racist, damn it."
Rockwood does not teach so-called critical race theory that's upsetting parents, according to Terry Harris, the district's director of student support services.
"What Rockwood School District is teaching is how to make sure that all kids belong, how to diversify our curriculum, how to expand books and different thoughts and create critical thinkers. Yeah, we do have that."
Harris attended Rockwood through St. Louis's school desegregation program. He's worked for the district now for a decade and a half. But online recently, he's been called, quote, the cancer of the Rockwood School District, and told he should go to a failing school district that is predominantly students of color and be the change there. In the past year, he and another Black administrator have received death threats that have prompted the district to hire security for the two educators and increase the number of police officers at school board meetings.
Some of these emails, some of the phone calls, some of the messages, it gets to you, right? It gets to you, it gets to your family.
But Harris says he's tried to approach it all with grace.
I think right now there's a lack of trust. Everyone is coming from this space of wrongdoing.
Harris isn't the only one in the crosshairs. The district's diversity coordinator is leaving after being trolled online, and the parent group has criticized a newly hired Black administrator. In the private Facebook group, several questioned the new assistant principal's background. They called her former St. Louis public school awful, and the historically Black college where she's a professor, a complete joke. One parent said her personal bankruptcy was a red flag on being able to handle school finances. Jamie Bays, the president of Rockwood School Board, says the attacks are hurtful.
My goal for her would be to make sure that she feels welcome here. And I think if there is work being done to the opposite of that, then I think that is extremely unfortunate.
Shamia Reese, a parent of five, says Rockwood has made improvements around diversity since she enrolled her oldest son through the DSEG program 15 years ago. But right now,
the sense of community that I felt pre-pandemic is totally different from the sense of community that I see now. And what I see now is hurtful, it's bitter, it's shameful.
And she adds, the kids are watching. I'm Ryan Delaney, St. Louis Public Radio.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
Stop focusing on racism.
This week, we're celebrating NPR's 50th anniversary, kicking off a series we're calling We Hold These Truths, to examine what's working and what's not in American democracy. And one of the underpinnings of democracy, without question, is property ownership. You see, there was a time when owning property was required simply to participate in this democracy. Yet we began as a nation that considered Black people to be property, to be three-fifths of a person.
There's also an assumption in this country that owning a home is the best way to build intergenerational wealth. But more than a century and a half after the end of slavery, property ownership eludes Black Americans more than any other racial group. In fact, the gap between white and Black home ownership is bigger today than it was in 1960, when race-based discrimination in the U.S. was still legal.
So this week, we're going to look at the structural forces, both from the government and the real estate industry, that have denied Black Americans a fair shot at the American dream of home ownership. One person who has spent many years thinking and writing about this is Kiyenga Yamada Taylor. She wrote the book Race for Profit, a finalist for the 2020 Pulitzer Prize in History, and she's going to help us open our series. We began our conversation discussing why homes owned by Black Americans don't accrue value the same way that white-owned homes do.
The market is a reflection of social attitudes in our society. I think sometimes we are led to believe that the market is this neutral space where supply and demand are the only thing that dictate how it functions.
Yeah.
And that's simply not true. The market is a reflection of that which we hold to be valuable, that which we see as desirable, that which we see as undesirable. And it's impossible to measure that without factoring in race in the United States.
And there has been a long-standing practice in real estate to connect race with the perception of risk, meaning it's considered riskier to loan to Black homebuyers. Can you talk about how the government helped perpetuate this perception through redlining?
So redlining is a practice that developed out of public policy in the 1930s. And essentially, the federal government, in response to the Great Depression, where millions of people were losing their homes and banks were no longer willing to lend money, created programs to help people refinance their homes. So the federal government were considering, what is a good neighborhood for us to refinance home loans of people in that community? And later, what is a good area for us to guarantee a home loan? And so you have the federal government acting as an insurance agency. And it meant that they created color-coded maps that originate in the 1930s. The most prized areas on these maps were blue, green, yellow, and then red, signified that an area had very old and dilapidated buildings. It was unlikely that value would accrue in these properties. And it also was to signify what kinds of people were moving into those areas, whether they were African-American immigrants or other undesirable populations. And this desire was built around the notion that some people are good for property values and some people are bad for property values. And this helped to really dictate where other business would invest. And this is really the moment where disinvestment and all of the consequences of that are really etched in policy. And we continue to see the reverberation of those public policy decisions made in the 1930s today.
Exactly. Consequences have flowed from those decisions. This perception that it's a bigger risk to loan to Black people. I mean, you have written about how that ends up becoming kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy for Black homeowners. Evidence we can see today.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It does become a self-fulfilling prophecy where if the federal government has refused to back mortgages in these areas, which signals to other businesses not to participate economically in these areas, then it means that there is greater levels of dilapidation and deterioration in the housing, because it's not just the big mortgage loans that Black people are excluded from, but the Federal Housing Administration was also giving white homeowners small maintenance repair loans so that they could keep up with maintenance issues with their homes. So African Americans and other people living in the redlined grade D areas on these residential maps are excluded from small repair loans as well. And so it means that the housing is in greater distress, is in greater disrepair. The lack of investment means there are fewer jobs. So these neighborhoods look depressed, but people coming through the neighborhood don't understand the public policy decisions that have been made that have created these conditions. Yeah. All they see are African Americans are living in these neighborhoods. The buildings are overcrowded, they're in disrepair. And so that becomes conflated with race.
Right. We've been talking up until now about financial hurdles facing Black Americans who want to accrue property wealth and the disinvestment that flows from that. But there have been other kinds of barriers blocking Black people in this country from owning homes. Let's talk about racially restrictive covenants. Briefly explain what those were.
So when property is sold, it's a rider included in the deed that says this property can only be sold to other white people. And it would list who would be excluded from sale. Sometimes it was Jewish people, different immigrant or ethnic groups, but primarily it was a tool to exclude sale from African Americans. And the reason that covenants became popular is because there was an initial effort by city governments to use what was called racial zoning, where city government could come up with racially designated blocks within a community and say, white people live here, Black people live there. But a 1917 Supreme Court decision said that that was a clear violation of the 14th Amendment. And so the real estate industry shifted to using racially restricted covenants as a way to keep African Americans legally locked out of white communities.
And, you know, even after racially restrictive covenants are deemed unenforceable by the Supreme Court in 1948, and even after redlining gets abolished by the Fair Housing Act in 1968, the imprint of these racist policies and practices remains. So I'm curious, how do you see the government and the private real estate industry working together still to keep Black Americans from owning homes?
Well, this is part of the problem. I mean, you can't have 35, 36 years of legal discrimination and then declare it over and expect that the legacy, the history, and the impact of those policies and practices just wither away overnight. Yeah. They have lasting effects that continue to mark African Americans as irresponsible homeowners, neighbors. It is used to designate African Americans as quote unquote subprime. It helps to constitute Black people as credit risks. And all of these factor into the differential treatment of African Americans in the housing market. And so this is an underlying explanation for what I describe as predatory inclusion, which is to say that no longer are African Americans being excluded from the market. Now they are being included. But this entire history of exclusion creates the basis upon which Black people are now included, but on different terms, with subprime loans, for example, paying higher interest rates, paying more fees because of the cumulative impacts of these policies and practices over these several decades, reconstituted their neighborhoods as risky, reconstituted them themselves as credit risks. And with risk come the legal pretext for treating Black consumers differently. So you can be included, but you have to pay an additional price to do so.
Kiyanga Yamada Taylor is a professor at Princeton University and author of Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Home Ownership. Thank you very much for lending us your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's not racism.
During the height of protests over Black Lives Matter last summer, a history buff in Indianapolis decided to bring people together by leading outdoor walking tours of African-American neighborhoods. NPR's Neda Ulubi got her own tour and has this report.
Samson Livingston is out all the time digging up stories of Indianapolis buildings and byways. His friends, he says, give him grief for never shutting up about local history.
You love history so much, almost like you think about it all day. I'm like, I do.
In college, Livingston did not major in history. He was an athlete, captain of his Division I football team.
I took all the history electives that I could. I'd even miss practice sometimes to sneak in an extra history elective.
It was his major in marketing that helped Livingston build his business leading tours.
Now, that's our Capitol building made out of Indiana limestone, Bedford, Indiana, limestone capital of the world.
This tour is really about other monuments, like the site of a historic African-American community center active in the 1920s when the Ku Klux Klan essentially ran local government.
Center Avenue YMCA was right here. It was once the largest Black YMCA in the country. Finding these cool stories, Black history, women's history, Native American history, things that I wasn't told about when I was a kid, and it's cool to discover them later on.
On his tours, Livingston points out what used to be the world headquarters of the first female self-made millionaire. Madam C.J. Walker sold Black hair care products. And he plays music by great Indiana jazzmen like Freddie Hubbard, Wes Montgomery, and Larry Ridley, who wrote a song called Indiana Avenue.
Indianapolis, they used to call it like Indian No Place. They used to call it Naptown because it was that boring. So they said there's nothing to do in Indianapolis after 6 p.m. People would actually come downtown and shoot pigeons off of light poles. Isn't that crazy?
Before this neighborhood around Indiana Avenue was gutted by an interstate and many of its buildings destroyed, Livingston says it was a hub of Black entertainment and commerce.
You look through your history book and you don't see too many Black people, so you're like, where do I fit in? And then you learn about the avenue and you're like, I fit in right here. Now, this is our Black Lives Matter mural right here on Indiana Avenue. Have you guys seen this before yet?
The words Black Lives Matter painted on the asphalt contain the names of victims of police violence.
Michael Taylor's name actually appears on this mural 4 different times.
Michael Taylor. He was 16 years old when he was shot in the head and killed while in the back of a squad car. Back in 1987, Indianapolis police, who'd picked up Taylor on suspicion of car theft, said the teenager committed suicide. He was handcuffed at the time. Part of Samson Livingston's tour today is visiting Taylor's mom.
I was born in 1954.
Nancy Taylor, in a cheerful yellow shirt, greets visitors in her garden. She does not talk about losing her son. She shares memories from her childhood when Indiana Avenue was filled with Black-owned businesses.
All up and down the avenue, we would walk and there were shops and little places where you would go get cheeseburgers and hamburger, Woody burgers.
When Nancy Taylor's son was killed, Samson Livingston was not even born. His walking tours came out of a year of police violence, protests, and the pandemic. And he says there's a reason why they've been so popular.
We need each other, like, bad. Like, more than we ever could have realized, you know. When I think that we just miss that. We miss people. We miss being who we are, and who we are matters.
Livingston is careful on his tours about masking and keeping apart, but in other ways, his tours are the opposite of social distancing. Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
There's nothing wrong with black people that ending racism can't solve.
Life for people facing eviction because of the pandemic just became more uncertain. Yesterday, a federal judge ruled the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does not have the authority to stop landlords from evicting people during a pandemic. Nothing will go into effect while the Justice Department appeals on behalf of the CDC. Lee Camp is a housing attorney in St. Louis who's been helping people navigate the complex process of hanging on to their homes in the face of eviction, and he's also one of our American indicators, people we've been talking to this year about how the pandemic is affecting different parts of the economy. Lee, it's good to have you back.
Hey, Ari. It's great to speak with you again.
What went through your head when you first saw that the judge had ruled to revoke the CDC's eviction moratorium?
Yeah, I was certainly overwhelmed yesterday when we saw the ruling. I found out through a text message from a friend and immediately dropped what I was doing to just try and figure out what had happened and what the judge had actually ruled. Pretty disheartening.
So the ruling is on hold, as we said, but the last time we spoke, you explained some of the complexities of this process of getting an eviction waiver, which was not straightforward to begin with. How does a ruling like this actually affect your clients?
Well, it certainly has injected another layer of confusion into their lives, particularly those who were using the protections of the CDC moratorium as their kind of last hope from keeping a roof over their head or being displaced into the streets. And, you know, I'm getting calls daily, as we've spoken about frequently, but really, within the past day, it has been from other individuals just wanting to know, what does this actually mean?
And what do you tell them? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of uncertainty.
That's right. You know, in fact, I had a meeting with some of my colleagues, and we're still trying to process exactly where we stand at this very moment. Now, we all agree the CDC moratorium is certainly in effect right now, but we're uncertain about what we're going to be looking at even tomorrow at this point. It was a very alarming day yesterday.
Yeah. I know you represent renters, but at the same time, there are landlords who haven't been paid in more than a year who are also in a tough spot. Do you think there's a way to keep people housed while also keeping the people who own these properties solvent?
Yeah, certainly. And really, Congress did address this. They've addressed it in the past two relief packages that have passed. There are billions of dollars in rental assistance funds that are available in our communities throughout this country. And that money is to stabilize not only the renter, but the landlord as well. And it really is to lead to true housing stability in this country as in response to the pandemic. But unfortunately, if we do not have time for both renters and the landlords to work together to get access to that money, we are certainly looking at not only a public health crisis related to the housing market, we're looking at a public health crisis and then an economic crisis really directly on top of that.
Well, you talk
about
this housing
that works is time.
Yeah, you talk about those housing relief funds, and the last time you and I spoke, it was about a month after President Biden signed the latest COVID relief bill into law. Have people in your community been able to access those funds?
People are slowly starting to access those funds, and the applications are overwhelming, as one might assume at this time, but people are applying. You know, we're getting calls. We have social workers that work in my office here, and they're helping people navigate these application processes. I'm getting calls from landlords that say, I want to work with you. I don't want to fight with you in court. How do we work together to get people caught up on their rent? And we're working through those programs, but unfortunately, if we do not have this time to actually kind of mediate that process and guide everyone through it, then what is the purpose of the rental assistance to ensure long-term housing stability?
And I imagine even if people qualify for the assistance, if the money actually arrives a week or even a day too late, they may have lost their home already.
That's exactly right. You know, in many communities, evictions are happening in this country, and the last protection was this moratorium. So if you don't have that protection of the moratorium, even if you're waiting on the money, you really could be out of luck.
So just in our last 30 seconds, if the moratorium is lifted, what do you expect to see?
Well, I expect the feeling that I felt yesterday, that we had fallen off a cliff, to just be here. I truly expect the 10 million or so families that may be facing the threat of housing instability in this country to begin being evicted and turned into the streets.
Lee Camp is a housing attorney who advocates for people facing eviction in the St. Louis area. Thank you so much for talking with us again.
Yeah, thank you, Ari.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The average daily pace of COVID vaccinations is slowing in the U.S., so how do you persuade the unvaccinated? NPR's Tamara Keith sat in on a focus group aimed at figuring out what will change their minds.
In March, Lauren from New Jersey wasn't ready to roll up her sleeve and get vaccinated for COVID-19.
It's just that I'm still skeptical. There's just not enough, just so new. It's scary. I think I'm going to get there. I'm just not ready yet.
Lauren was part of a focus group led by Republican pollster Frank Luntz. He's working with a public health foundation to develop messaging that appeals to people who are reluctant to get the vaccine. His latest focus group revisited people like Lauren, who ended up getting the shot.
Lauren, what's the precise moment when you decided you'd get vaccinated?
When we found out that we could go to a Yankee game if we're vaccinated. So my husband's like, we got to get vaccinated.
The group who gathered via Zoom was diverse. There were conservatives and liberals, and at times they openly bickered about politics. In the end, though, what moved them were a series of personal calculations. Marie from New York took to heart an explanation she heard from former CDC director Tom Frieden, who walked through how the vaccines work, and her own doctor told her it was safe. Then she went about convincing her husband, whose friend recently died from COVID.
I told him, I said, do you want to get sick like this? The alternative is better than this. I said, your parents got it. One of your closest friends got it and passed away. So he agreed.
Brian from Texas had thought the risks from the virus were overhyped, but he came around to the vaccine anyway.
I considered it and I looked at the math, and then everybody at work decided to get it, to go ahead and get vaccinated. So at that point, I decided to go ahead and do it too.
For Raphael from California, it was about being able to return to group therapy.
I just need to deal with my depression. I need to have some normalcy back to my life.
So he pushed past his fears.
Being able to go to a Dodger game, being able to travel, you need to have the vaccination to do it. And for me, beating my depression was more important than my fear of the vaccine.
Elizabeth from Pennsylvania said she still has lingering doubts about the safety of the vaccines.
My fears about getting vaccinated are honestly still there. And I have both doses, right? I'm still a little, I read articles and I think, oh goodness, is there going to be something they discover? It's still here.
She says the balance just tipped over time. The pros outweighed the cons. If there was one clear overriding message from this group, it came down to trust.
Victor from Michigan, I know you don't trust. Who do you trust when it comes to information on the vaccine?
My doctor.
Why your doctor?
Because he is the one who knows all of my health issues.
After several people said the same thing, Luntz turned to Shirley from Nevada.
You guys keep telling me about your doctor. Why is that so powerful for you?
Because that's who I trust.
Dr. Brian Castrucci of the de Beaumont Foundation, which sponsored the focus groups, said his takeaway is healthcare providers are a key part of the next phase of getting more people vaccinated.
It needs to become a new vital sign. What's your height? What's your weight? Do you smoke? Have you been vaccinated against COVID? Every physician, every visit needs to ask that question.
This reinforces what Biden administration officials have been saying. People who haven't gotten vaccinated yet don't want a lecture, but they do need their questions answered. Bishara Shuker is the White House vaccinations coordinator.
We know that physicians and nurses are such trusted messengers. And once they get the answers and once they get the facts, people change their mind and get ready to be vaccinated.
One challenge, though, is actually getting vaccines into physicians' offices. It's something the Biden administration and others are working to address. Because when someone makes that decision, you don't want to have to tell them they need to find an appointment somewhere else. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Medical apartheid.
The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present.
A moral catastrophe, that's how the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, describes the gap on distribution of vaccines between rich and poor countries. He says billions of dollars are needed to fund the COVAX program, which provides doses to low-income nations. The WHO chief also called for patent or IP rules on vaccines to be waived, allowing the drugs to be produced more widely in countries with low vaccination rates.
If we're going to vaccinate majority of the adults to bring herd immunity, then the amount of vaccine we need will be significantly more than what we have now. So the production capacity should increase, and that's why the IP waiver will be very important.
Our correspondent Imogen Folks in Geneva told us more.
The WHO is repeating again what it said from the start, which is a plea for fair access to vaccines and not to allow the poorest countries on the planet to slip behind. Because, you know, you cannot achieve control of a virus which is spread around the world if only some parts of the world are vaccinated. It will still keep spreading. It will still keep mutating at some point or other. There's going to be a mutation which could defeat the existing vaccines. That's the worry. Now, I've been reporting on this since the start of the pandemic, and right at the start, when we had even just the hint of a possible vaccine, the WHO said we need to vaccinate the most vulnerable and the health workers first. It isn't happening. And now we see this terrible surge in India, also in Brazil. The fear that this could spread to some of the really poorest nations in the world, sub-Saharan Africa, for example, where less than 1% of the population has had access to a vaccine so far.
It is extraordinary, isn't it, the difference in what's happening in the richer countries and the poor countries?
It really is. And I think for many specialists in global public health, where I think you'll find if you talk to these people, they have throughout their careers been confronted with the unfair access to health services. And this has kind of shown it really in the spotlight and shown how even when faced with this unprecedented once in a century crisis, we just don't seem to be able to work together. I mean, you have the United Kingdom and you have the United States racing ahead. And there have been suggestions from the World Health Organization that maybe the US and the UK don't need right now to offer the vaccine to the youngest and healthiest in their societies. Perhaps they could reach out a hand to countries who've had nothing at all so far, not even for their chronically ill and their health workers. But it's not happening. Politicians, I suppose, they need to please their voters, and that means making sure that everybody in their catchment area, if you like, gets a vaccine before people halfway around the world. But unfortunately, from a public health point of view, it's not necessarily the best investment. That's what the WHO keeps stressing over and over again.
Imogen Folks.
See, we're getting ready to be put in a real trap with this legalization of marijuana. So everybody, every black person can be unemployed and then they can sit in their corner and get high on marijuana with whatever they decide to put in it. And people won't be asking for jobs and being determined that they're going to get jobs and going to get an education. No, everybody can start getting high on marijuana because somebody said it's medicinal and it's legal.
What about?
So we better beware.
What about the people who say the legalization of marijuana is fighting against racism because you have so many black people who are unjustly incarcerated as a result of racist enforcement of these drug laws? So this would be a good thing, and it would keep black people out of greater confinement.
No, we can do it by stop using and selling drugs to one another. See, if I'm not using drugs, then I can't be incarcerated for drugs. And I see so many males, young males in my practice who would become psychotic, almost never to return to normal from marijuana use, because you don't know what's in it. You don't know how it's been genetically altered. Again, everything has to be put in the context.
Legal marijuana sales in Colorado have now topped $2 billion. Some of the products that have become popular are highly concentrated forms of THC, the main psychoactive compound in marijuana, and some there are worried about the mental health effects of those products. Colorado Public Radio's Benta Berkland reports.
Researchers say 80% of legal pot sales go to the 20% of customers who are regular users. And they're not just buying joints or marijuana flower that's become steadily more potent over the years. At the Roll-Up dispensary in Denver, Roll-Up's owner, Sherrard Rogers, says there are reasons why people want concentrates.
They're a cleaner product. They don't have the smell that a typical cannabis product would have, and it's cheaper.
Concentrates, like hash oils and waxes, can be upwards of 80% THC, the main psychoactive component in marijuana. Not a lot is known about the health risk of concentrates, but there are some concerning anecdotes.
Our lives were complete hell, and it was all about confiscating dab pens, cartridges, wax canisters, concentrate canisters.
Cynthia says her 16-year-old son's personality changed after he started using the highly concentrated products dispensaries sell. NPR is not using her last name to protect the privacy of her minor son. Last year, she called the police after he threw a rock at her head, and he went to the emergency room.
All those who saw him come in thought that it was either meth or heroin or high-dosage opioid.
But what doctors found was THC. There aren't good numbers for how often people have adverse reactions to cannabis concentrates. Scientists haven't established a causal link between concentrates and psychotic episodes. But Dr. Sam Wong with Children's Hospital Colorado says there is moderate to strong evidence of an association.
Obviously, we need more research on the impacts of these high-potency products, but also, do we want to wait 10 years down the road to see the overall impacts? Probably not.
Colorado's House Speaker Alec Garnett is proposing higher taxes on marijuana to fund new research. The Denver Democrat also wants to create a statewide system to track whether people buy more per day than the legal limit. He's especially worried about 18 to 21-year-olds who purchase it through the state's medical marijuana system.
It shouldn't be free reign. People shouldn't be able to go and buy 40 grams a day of the highest potency products on the marketplace, because there's no logical reason that you would actually need that.
Authorities say restricting young medical users would help prevent them from selling it to teens who aren't able to buy it legally. There is support in Colorado's marijuana industry to require better tracking of purchases and increase taxes for research. But many say they're already heavily regulated and taxed. Roll-Up dispensary owner Sherrard Rogers.
Aren't parents supposed to have the best interests of their children and be the gatekeepers for their children? It's not as if that we are selling a cannabis product out the back door. I want people coming in who are of age and are using it for the right purposes.
It's been 9 years since voters here made Colorado the first state to legalize recreational use of marijuana. Last year, sales brought in close to $400 million in state taxes. And the industry has a staunch ally in Democratic Governor Jared Polis. It's not a given that he'd sign new regulations. Any new taxes would have to be approved by voters. Polis and people in the business say they don't want regulations to trample on individual freedom. Peter Marcus is with Terrapin, a multi-state cannabis company based in Boulder.
These products then come out of nowhere, and for responsible adults, they should be able to make the decisions for themselves.
Colorado lawmakers are taking this issue up now, but don't have much time before the legislative session ends in about 6 weeks. And Colorado isn't alone in wrestling with how to regulate marijuana concentrates. Currently, Vermont is the only state with a THC cap in place. For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
Every nigger is a star. Every nigger is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigger is a star?
A Richford man faced a judge today after police say he tried to kill a man with his car, and police are calling it a racially motivated hate crime. Ike Ben David has the latest details.
27-year-old Anthony Mason pleaded not guilty Thursday to a slew of charges, including first-degree attempted murder with a hate crime enhancement. According to a police affidavit, Mason drove to Michael Wilson's house on Troy Street in Richford Wednesday morning, angry because he believed that Wilson was sleeping with his girlfriend. Police say that Mason was screaming racial slurs and saying that he was going to kill Wilson.
The one gentleman was upset with my neighbor because of something that supposedly happened, but to come flying down the street yelling the N-word, shouting the N-word and saying you're going to kill the N-word seems racially motivated to me.
Brandy Lena lives next door and says she woke up to Mason's truck zooming by and hearing the racial slurs yelled.
They then pulled up onto my neighbor's lawn. He was out there with his dog and they tried to run him over multiple times, running into his stuff, backing up, yelling that he was going to kill him.
He's out on an exposed porch driving a full-size pickup truck at the porch. There's a real possibility that he could accomplish his goal.
Court paperwork indicates Mason also threatened his girlfriend.
Prior to that, he had reportedly held a gun to his girlfriend's head and taken her phone.
Police say Mason admits to driving to Wilson's house and running over his dirt bike, but claims he left when Wilson ran out of the house with a gun. Here's what Wilson had to say leaving his house on Thursday.
I honestly got no comment. It's too stressful.
He was my friend. Happened, friend. People need to understand that.
Mason was held without bail and is expected to be back in court at a later date. In Richford, Ike Ben David, Channel 3 News.
The man race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
The trial of a woman who says the French police are responsible for her brother's death wrapped up in a Paris court today. Her brother was a black man who died in police custody. She says he was asphyxiated, just like George Floyd. She's been fighting to bring the officers to justice for the last 5 years, but it wasn't the officers on trial today. She was, for defaming them. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Hundreds of supporters gathered outside the Paris courthouse in support of Assa Traoré. They chanted, "Justice for Adama." That's Traoré's younger brother who died in July 2016 at the age of 24. Since then, Assa Traoré has been on a relentless but so far unsuccessful pursuit of justice. On the third anniversary of her brother's death, Assa wrote an open letter naming and accusing three policemen and several others, including medical examiners and judges, of obstructing justice by hiding the real cause of her brother's death. The three officers sued her for defamation. Sociologist Eric Fassin was an expert witness for Traoré this week. He says this trial is a distraction from the main issue of what happened to her brother, and nothing has advanced in that case.
Many people in France have to wonder, is the justice system a way to correct the abuses of the state, or is the state fully on the side of the police system?
After George Floyd's death last year, protests calling for justice for Adama Traoré broke out across France. His sister Assa is now the face of the fight against racism and discrimination. 26-year-old Wissam Tabia was waiting to get into the courtroom. He says young people are inspired by her.
C'est peut-être quelque part une bonne chose qu'elle soit.
Somehow it's actually good that she's in front of the justice system, because she's following the rules and the process. All this is really reverberating, and it could have an impact when we get back to the real story, which is these three policemen.
In court, Traoré stood by her accusations and her manifesto, which she titled J'accuse, or I accuse. It recalls writer Émile Zola's famous condemnation of the French military's anti-Semitic conviction of Jewish Colonel Alfred Dreyfus for treason in the 19th century. Fassin says that was powerful.
The reference to the Dreyfus affair is a way of deciding that we can think about the present in the light of the past, even though the targets may not be the same.
Outside the courthouse, many people say Derek Chauvin's conviction for George Floyd's death gives them hope. Law student Jennifer Currier says the French have really woken up to the problem of police racism in the last year.
Well, way more angry and way more hopeful. I feel the things are changing, and because she's here, it shows that they are afraid, you know? She's close. She's close to succeed.
But sociologist Fassin says what happened to her brother, Adama, cannot go unpunished or treated as a non-event, because to do so would put democracy itself at risk. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
That there was no such place. I had a vague idea that Rio de Janeiro was a place, so I kind of kept that in the back of my mind in reserve. And if all these other places fail, I could probably wind up, join the Navy or something and go to Rio, and I could escape for a few minutes from being black. And a lot of black people thought that way in the back of their minds. They were looking for a place. That's the gist of what I'm saying. But the racists, this thing called white supremacy over a period of years, about 1957 while I was in Japan, I began to realize that you got to turn around and just grab it. It's no place to run.
In Rio de Janeiro yesterday, a police raid targeting suspected drug traffickers turned deadly. It shocked the neighborhood where it happened and is believed to be the deadliest police operation in the history of Rio. Residents and local officials are accusing the police of using excessive force and are now demanding an investigation. From Brazil, Michael Fox has the latest.
Yesterday, the residents of the poor Jacarezinho favela on the north end of Rio de Janeiro woke up to this. Gunfire. And this. Police helicopters spin over the neighborhood in this video posted on Twitter by the local Jacarezinho media team, Labjaca. That's a problem, says a man off camera. Those guys are shooting down on the neighborhood from up above. 200 officers participated in the police raid. We're stuck inside, suffocating from the tear gas, and we can't go out, one resident posted on Twitter. As the hours passed, the body count rose. When the bullets stopped flying, residents poured from their homes to protest. Murderers! Dozens of young women shout in this video live streamed over social media. They march through the narrow streets of the neighborhood chanting, "Justice! Justice! Justice!" All told, it was the deadliest Rio de Janeiro police operation ever. 25 people were killed, including one police officer. 3 people were injured. 2 commuters were hit by stray bullets on a passing train. At an afternoon press conference, civil police said they had prepared the raid for 10 months and had gone in to arrest 21 members of a criminal gang accused of enticing children and adolescents into drug trafficking. They said they had detained 10 people, followed all protocols, but didn't celebrate the high death count. For residents, the day was a nightmare. That's a mother who lost her son in a video shared online. They pointed the gun at me and said I was going to die, she says. Other women by her side keep repeating, killers, killers. Joel Luis Costa is a lawyer who grew up in Jacarezinho. He spent the afternoon witnessing the aftermath and collecting testimonies from residents.
Isso aqui não é democracia. É só falando que caralho, isso aqui é cenário de guerra e a gente não merece.
This is not democracy, Costa tells the camera in a Twitter video. His eyes are bloodshot from the tears. He's wearing a gray suit and tie. A surgical face mask hangs over one ear. This is a war scene, and we don't deserve to live in a war scene. He said he visited 5 or 6 homes. He says they all look the same. Homes turned upside down. Execution-style shots. There were no signs of crossfire. A boy was killed sitting in a chair. You don't fire back when you're sitting in a chair. This was an execution, he says. Calls for investigations have echoed across the city, from local officials to members of the city's public defenders.
Não temos pena de morte no Brasil. E, portanto, não é...
In this video, over social media, Rio de Janeiro Legislative Assembly member Renata Souza says, we don't have the death penalty in Brazil, and therefore it's not up to the police to decide who should die and who should live in our society. We had a slaughter in Jacarezinho today, and it needs to be investigated, she said. This was not the first violent police operation in Rio's favelas. According to the figures, police in Rio have killed roughly 150 people each month this year. But the police raids, they shouldn't even be taking place. Last June, due to the pandemic, Brazil's Supreme Court banned all Rio de Janeiro police operations in poor communities except in the most extreme circumstances. The impact in the following months was unprecedented. Police killings dropped by 66%. The number of violent and nonviolent crimes also sank, according to a paper released last month by Jesse Bullock, a PhD candidate at Harvard University.
In some ways, it's actually a little surprising to me how effective it was initially in the first 90 days after the ruling. And the more time passes, as we see that the police gradually started to disrespect the ruling and discount it.
Bullock says that Rio's police justify their violence as a necessary means for securing the city.
They think the only way to fight trafficking and to decrease organized crime is with these types of operations and with and like fighting force with force. This was even something that Bolsonaro himself campaigned on, that force, you fight force with force slogan.
Police say they've done everything by the books. And critics say that, in a twisted way, that's true. Fabiana da Silva works with the Rio de Janeiro Human Rights Ombudsman Office, and she grew up in a favela in northern Rio de Janeiro.
Extremamente normal, assim. É uma coisa tão absurda.
She says, the police are acting totally normal. Totally normal. It's so absurd. In April, there was a public hearing about police operations in the favelas, the same day there were raids in two different favelas, she says. The Supreme Court has set a date for later this month to discuss the Rio de Janeiro police operations. Many hope the calls for investigations lead to action and to accountability for this police raid and the ones to come. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Yeah, that was the summertime, but you know what comes with the summertime. Beef.
Where's the beef?
First of all, nobody is taking away your meat. Let's just say that right up front. In recent weeks, claims of a quote-unquote war on meat are being pushed by the usual suspects in response to the Biden administration's moves to address climate change. It was falsely suggested multiple times on Fox News and by some Republican members of Congress that President Biden's climate plan will limit red meat eating in order to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Biden has not proposed a limit on red meat consumption. However, some in the food world are taking seriously the connection between greenhouse gas emissions and the beef we consume. Last week, Epicurious, one of the largest cooking websites, announced that it will no longer publish new recipes that include beef in an effort to promote more sustainable cooking, but it won't remove the old ones. And on Monday, a high-end New York restaurant, 11 Madison Park, announced that their return to in-person dining next month will come with a twist, an entirely vegan menu. We wanted to understand what all these decisions add up to, so to help us answer that, we've called Mark Bittman. He is a food writer and has been eating, cooking, and advocating for more plant-forward diets now for more than a decade. His new book, Animal Vegetable Junk, is out now. Mark Bittman, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Great to be here.
So could you just, you know, set the table for us, as it were? You see what I did there? How much impact does beef have on climate change and the planet, or maybe meat more broadly? Could you just tell us the baseline there?
First of all, separating the environmental impact of animal products from climate change is kind of tricky. And separating the impact of agriculture from fossil fuel production, since agriculture is so fossil fuel reliant, is also tricky. But it is safe to say that agriculture in general and animal production in particular, and most particularly beef, so sort of in that in that cascading order are huge contributors to climate change. And the production of beef alone generates around, and a real broad, around 10% of our total greenhouse gases.
Why are the emissions from meat so much more significant than, say, the fossil fuel inputs of big farms and things like that? Why does the production of meat cause so many more emissions than the production of plants?
Well, because you have to farm plants in order to feed animals. So whatever greenhouse gas generating you're doing from producing corn and soybeans and other commodity crops for all purposes, those are part of animal production.
How long have people in the food world been talking about encouraging people to eat a more plant-forward diet? As I said, you know, you've been doing this for years and you've got cookbooks on all kinds of subjects. I mean, you have, you know, how to cook everything. You have how to cook vegetables. I mean, you've got, you're not an ideologue on this point, if I can sort of put it that way. But how long have people in your field and in the world of kind of food writ large been talking about encouraging people to move toward more of a plant-forward diet?
I'm going to hat tip here to Francis Moore LePay, who wrote Diet for a Small Planet in the 70s. And Diet for a Small Planet argued that by feeding animals grain, we were depriving less well-off people around the world of nutrition. So that's a 50-year-old, at least a 50-year-old conversation. It really accelerated in 2007 when the UN, the FAO, produced a report called Livestock's Long Shadow, which said, at the time, said 17% of greenhouse gas production could be attributed to industrial production of animals. Now, that number is not current, and it could be more and it could be less, but that was the first report that said significant amounts of greenhouse gas, significant progress in climate change can be attributed to the way we raise animals.
Hmm. So what do you think about the decision for Epicurious to stop publishing beef recipes? It's just been interesting how much of a reaction that it's gotten. Some just really sharp criticism for making the move away from beef. I'm just interested in, first of all, what's your take on it and what do you make of the reaction to it?
I mean, there's no reason to be critical of it. I mean, no reason at all. First of all, if anyone invents a beef recipe that doesn't already exist, kudos to them, because that's a really hard thing to do. Second of all, they're not saying we're not publishing beef recipes. They're saying we're not publishing new beef recipes. They have thousands in their archive. Third, it's brought the issue a lot of attention. Here we are talking about it. It's a great move by them. Look, Joe Biden doesn't have the power to get us to stop eating meat, obviously, but we do need to eat less meat for a variety of reasons. And that is the trend. It's going to be the trend. We're going to be eating less meat 50 years from now than we do now. It's to everyone's benefit. So the fact that we're talking about it, the fact that people are doing it, these are good things.
Why do you think there's such a reaction to it, though? Why do you think there's such an intense reaction to it? I mean, it just seems like so visceral for some people. Why is that? Is there something about beef that's connected to feeling affluent or something? What is it?
I think it's more that there's something about beef that's connected to the same kind of rights that we associate with guns. I think it's just there are people who don't want government to govern, to make decisions that are beneficial for all of us, like reducing the number of guns in the United States would be a good thing. Reducing the amount of meat that we eat in the United States would be a good thing.
Why do you say we're all going to be eating less meat in the future anyway? Why do you say that?
Well, the amount of meat that we're producing, even in the United States, is unsustainable. For everybody to eat as much meat as Americans eat, we would need four times the resources that the world has now. And we're talking about petroleum, we're talking about land, we're talking about water. We're talking about waste disposal. There just isn't the room or the resources for all of this to happen.
That is Mark Bittman. He is a longtime food writer and author of many, many books. As you know, his latest is Animal Vegetable Junk, which is out now. Mark Bittman, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of White Supremacy. Get my little plug in for more plant-based eating. Today's date, Saturday, May 8, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, counter-racist suggestions. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Things to share before we get to the folks who dialed in live. Let's see. So we are almost done in the book club. Geronimo Pratt's biography, Last Man Standing by Jack Olson. This is our natural follow-up to Johnny Cochran and Christopher Darden, Marsha Clark, when we read about O.J. Simpson, Jeffrey Toobin's book. This is our natural follow-up to get more information about Johnny Cochran, what he said, most important case of his life. And this book actually ends with Geronimo Pratt's release and O.J. Simpson case, because that was just about a year and a half or so before Geronimo Pratt's release, about 2 years before. Anywho, I had been talking about, you know, what should we read after this and other books that come up, and Harriet A. Washington has a new book as well. I was listening to John Patash, his first visit on the Cows way back in 2009. He was talking about Tupac Shakur and his relationship with Geronimo Pratt, his so-called godfather, and how all of that related to COINTELPRO. Listened to several portions where he was talking about Tupac Shakur and Geronimo Pratt, the Panthers, whole nine, all of that. And he mentioned the book Labyrinth, about the assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G. I think way back when we were reading, still about O.J. Simpson, I said all of that should be put in context in terms of the rioting, 1992, beating of Rodney King, the O.J. Simpson trial, 1995, the assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G., and the Rampart scandal. All of that should be looked at in context in terms of understanding white supremacy, the system of white supremacy locally as it relates to Los Angeles, and the white supremacy enforcement officials and how they dominated and terrorized black people in that region for the decade of the 90s. But you could put all of that together and just the LAPD's involvement in all of those cases alone. Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G., their assassinations, O.J. Simpson trial, Rodney King, Rampart, all of that that happened in the 1990s. Anyway, so I was thinking of all that yesterday, and I said, maybe we should read Labyrinth next. Popular book. It's a little bit older now, but about the assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G., putting those murders in proper context, LAPD's involvement in those crimes, particularly all the focus on police and what have you right now. So maybe we should read that. I have to take a turn. I did give it a glance. Johnny Cochran is mentioned a lot in that book, so it seems we would get more information on Johnny Cochran. Of course, Rodney King is mentioned a lot, and O.J. Simpson and all the rest. But I mean, I will have to give it a thought. Labyrinth, very popular. I think it might have been a bestseller. It's about 20 years old at this point. And I believe this year we are coming up on the, it's been 25 years since the assassination of Tupac Shakur, 1996. So maybe have to give it some thought. I know we definitely had talked about reading the manifesto as it's reported, Elliot Rodger, killer from 2014. Dr. Welsing talked about his act quite a bit on the program. He has a white parent, non-white parent, cowbell. But we'll have to see. Maybe we can get them both in. But seriously thinking about Labyrinth, that can kind of be our trilogy in the book club. Anyway, next. Let's see. The report, they talked about the, or two of the early reports that we featured, the sex trafficking ring in Europe involving all these different so-called countries, and then specifically in Chicago, the segment where they reported that the public pool that seemed some of the lifeguards were taking advantage of and sexually molesting, raping some of the other staff members and folks who were using the public pool and or worked at the facility. We said for years, if you are an attempted parent, they got so-called Mother's Day tomorrow. If you are an attempted parent, you have got to talk to your children about racism, white supremacy. You have got to talk to your children about sexual predators, sexual abuse. It is so rampant. That segment easily could have been in workplace racism, because that's what they said with the thing in Chicago. The sexual abuse report at the Chicago swimming facility easily could have been on our neutralizing workplace racism broadcast. But there's so much of that is encouraged. I think that idiot has said for a long time, white people don't care about children, certainly don't care about non-white children. It's just rampant in terms of the sexual abuse. As I said, really make sure that you go over and even maybe show these reports to your offspring so that they can be aware of how often this sort of thing happens in areas that are close to probably where you are, anywhere in the world. Networks and things like they talked about in the segment, like be honest so that your child can be alert and they can share if they see anything or they hear about anything untoward, school or whatever else it is, they can share. Communication great for safety. Let's see, next, man, talk about children. Okay, the segment in St. Louis started with Michael Brown Jr. They had that big report on ProPublica, I believe, my memory might be off, Nicole Hannah Brown, non-white female, white parent. She did a segment on Michael Brown Jr. and how awful the school system. It's Nicole Hannah Jones. That's it. Sorry. Make sure we strive for accuracy. But she did that segment on how awful the school is in St. Louis, where Michael Brown Jr. attended, with mostly black people, not accredited, falling apart, plaster dropping on your head and what have you. The rats stole, you know, the lunch trays, all the rest of it. Back in like 2014, and talking about, you know, what a disgrace it was. And he was a victim way before we got to the shooting in the summer of 2014. Anyway, so they get to this segment that we heard today in Rockwood. Now, I don't know exactly where that is in Missouri, but it was on St. Louis Public Radio, so I assume it's pretty close to Ferguson, much closer than I am here in Seattle. So they're talking about all this at Rockwood. Wow, the metaphors. This here is our compensatory call-in. So this is the program where we're supposed to be not using metaphors and really alert about word use. From the very beginning of the segment, they say, ooh-wee, we have got lots of little fires here in Missouri, show me state, lots of little fires. And this whole school situation, it just turned into a wildfire. What the world? And then they go over there and they say, and then teaching about diversity in schools, that became a batch of kindling. Said they are just going to continue with it. Really, really, you can't just give me the news and skip all the lame fire metaphors and what have you. Anyway, so they keep rolling with the segment. So they have apparently a bunch of parents, I suspect individuals classified as white. They don't want to hear all this critical race theory and talking about diversity in schools. They said, even included, they said, we do not want a whole bunch of books with the main character as black people in the books. I said, really? Are they complaining about the new American classic, The Hate U Give? That's what they're complaining about? We're tired of all these, you know, Negro leads and what have you. Cowbell for that, too. I said, I don't know. I'd have to see the book list to see, you know, what literature they got a gripe about with these main black characters. So they continue to say, we don't want all this
about diversity, racial, critical race theory, and all that. Then, oh my goodness, they have the meeting. They said, we get hundreds of parents together. Nicole Hannah Jones, she talked about that too before, when they were going to get black children and bring them into the district, and they were going to charge and all that. And then, we don't want these ruffians. Get them out of here. Protect our white children. Anyway, so they get the segment and they hear the white woman, and she stands up. Oh my, you know, that is going to be sound clip and played like in infamy. She stands up teary eyed. I don't even know if I can do the dramatic effect, if I can do a proper rendition, but she says, I do not want to hear about critical race theory. I taught my children, you love everybody, white people, brown people, black people, polka dot people, you love everybody. Just because I don't want to have my child exposed to critical race theory doesn't mean I'm a racist, damn it. And she ran off like To Kill a Mockingbird in tears. Who, ma'am, who called you a racist? You can still just stay in the question lane. But that type of scene, I said for you, is the weeping white woman. You already lost. Like, she'll have the entire white auditorium. And a lot of times it'll be a lot of victims, too, that will be right there. The first ones with Kleenex. Oh, my gosh. Let me give you a hug, Jane. We hate critical race theory, too. That no good Chris Rock. Oh, just come here. Let me give you a hug. We know you love everybody. Yes, you do. No one said you're racist. No one's a racist but that old Al Sharpton, because that's how we've been trained to behave that way. Farrah Winfrey, she explained that on the program way back in 2007. We were broadcasting on the University of Washington radio network, but weeping white woman, woo, gonna take it out. That segment, in fact, was ludicrous. It was ludicrous and like astounding all at the same times at points. Even before we got to the weeping white woman, doesn't make me a racist, damn it. Before we got to that, they said, you know, the schools used to be not political. Now, we can start with definitions. Now, I don't know what you mean by political. Mr. Fuller said anything dealing with people is politics. But I mean, hey, didn't they have a decision that went all the way to the Supreme Court about schools? I thought that happened. It seems people get rowdy about schools all the time. I don't want to read The Hate U Give, or we should read The Hate U Give, or whatever it is. We shouldn't have security resource officers in the school, or we should, or we shouldn't have niggers here at all, or whatever it is. It seems like on a pretty regular basis, people get political, if you want to use that term, about what happens at the school. I have no idea what she's talking about. She said, schools weren't political. We could all just come together at the game and root on the team. We can't even have a decision about what the name of the school mascot is going to be. Are we going to be the Coons? Are we going to be the Centralville Chicksaw Indians? Are we going to be the Cincinnati Reds? Redskins? You know, we can't even get a name without having to talk about racism, white supremacy, and politics. So, no, in my view, just lying, because I mean, you vote sometimes on who's going to be serve on the school board and school board officials and all that, superintendent. You vote about these things sometimes. So I think this person was lying. Schools are very political, and anybody that doesn't believe it, you know, go to your next PTA meeting and you don't even have to say anything. Just watch and see if you think you're observing something related to politics. Anyway, that segment, I just said metaphors because that whole segment was a metaphor. If I was going to use a metaphor, if me listening to that segment was a boxing match, Gusty would have been knocked out, or at minimum, I think the fight would have been stopped, because I literally had to take about 3 or 4 different knees. I mean, literally, I was standing up, I was listening. They got to the point, the white woman stood up. does it make me a racist, Dent? That was knee number one. Boop, I took a knee. They would have counted. Get me to eight. See if you can get up and continue. They kept going for a little while, and they said the parents, they didn't want to talk about the different the books that had main characters as black people and all the rest of it. And they said that they tried to hide the list of what was going to be on the reading material because they didn't want to get in trouble, and the parents found out about it, and then they had the meeting and all that. When they said that the black educators were threatened about all of this and they threatened their families, boop, I took knee number two. They brought on the white educator who said, hey, he didn't want to rankle all these people by not talking about diversity and thought this is important. And they felt he was kind of kowtowing, so to speak, to the liberal agenda and teaching all this Marxist material. Wrote in and told him, man up, grow a pair. That was knee number three. That's why I said that this had been a boxing match. Gus T knocked out. Down goes Gus T. Down goes repeatedly. Like, I would not have made it through the segment. Just what is going on? All the metaphors that we got, kindling flying and wildfires. And are we talking about racism, white supremacy in the school? What are we even talking about here? Astounding. I'm going to have to look on the map to find out where the Rockwood school system is. But wow, if you ever needed any sort of motivation or encouragement to have like a serious dialogue way before your child is conceived about what is our academic plan going to look like for the first, you know, 10 years at least for our offspring. What is it going to look like? Let's really do something to earn our celebration for Mother's Day and Father's Day if we're all into that. Hey, we planned your academic program 5 years before you were conceived. You better have me all kinds of goodies ready for Mother's Day. All right, we'll get cracking, get baking right now. But I mean, hey, you should be motivated, because if not, that's what you will have waiting for your child. Michael Brown Jr., indeed. Grow a pair, Welsing moments, my goodness. Let's see. Oh, wait a minute, I forgot. I didn't even get them all. They told the black educator, so he gets all the threats. They threaten his family members and what have you. They told him, they said, hey, why don't you go and work in the Negro school district and be the change? Woo! That was another one, right? That's why I said fight would have been stopped, because, like, you can't take that many. You can't get dropped that many times and have the fight continue. Like, wow. It does not get any better than tacky. You're going to take that one and twist it around, as opposed to shipping all of you Negro ruffians over here. Why don't you all go over there? And what are they? How do they say? Be the change elsewhere. Wow. Wow. Put a quote on it. Just put your name by it. Sign it so we know who said it. Like, it does not get any better than tacky. Fuller said, white people can show you better than I can tell you what it means to be white. They learn them well down in Missouri. What is it? The Show Me State, aptly named. Let's see. They continued with the reports. They had talked a little bit about some of the changes with the Rona and trying to get the vaccine out to non-white areas of the world. I said I've seen that the whole time. It looks like on the macro and the micro, non-white people globally having less access to all of these so-called vaccines. We'll have to see all of how all of that proceeds. Incidentally, they've been saying that here in the States, at least with Washington State and I think a number of other places, that they have curtailed requests for vaccines because people are still not interested. I think they did a report, the Chicago Police Department, very low numbers of officers vaccinated. They apparently didn't, you know, want to get their shot. They said Washington State, same thing, that they have rolled back their requests for vaccinations because people are just not getting jabs at a really high rate at this point. So I don't know. It is a lot to kind of process. They said they've had a major uptick in sales for airline tickets, and people are booking all kinds of travel plans for the summer. And so we are done with all of this quarantine. It is, you know, breakout for summertime. So we will have to see how things progress over the next few months or so. Graduation and all the rest of the holidays, maybe even family reunions if people haven't done that in a couple years or so. Let's see. The report man, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, when they talked about the cannabis situation in Colorado, very close to Washington State, and they talked about some of the mental health components, and particularly for young people, which I thought was, you know, super important, and saying, hey, what are the mental health aspects, especially for all these concentrates and such, and for younger people whose brains are still developing and them using these really high concentrations of this substance, like what type of impact is that having on them? I thought that was super important. I would have loved to hear what third generation physician Dr. Welsing would have had to say about that, because I don't think they've had very much research on, you know, some of these different types of products and what have you that have not existed for, you know, a long time, at least to my knowledge, all these different concentrates and what have you. And I don't know any black people that have laboratories set up where they do these type of studies. Oh, my goodness. Wait a minute. Speaking of labs and institutions set up by black people, that's why I said I would not have made it out of that Rockwood segment. Like, they would have just had to stop. I couldn't even do any rewinds because I'd have just had to rewind the whole segment. They ridiculed the black educators' credentials who went to a black college. And white people are ignorant about racism. Man. And they said that the black educator, it's a red flag. That's another metaphor. A red non-white flag that she had some sort of personal bankruptcy. I thought Donald Trump became president. Didn't he have a bankruptcy or three? What does it mean to be white? Can you be ignorant about racism, white supremacy? Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure get in before shove off? They talked in the segment, they were doing the walking tours in Indianapolis, Indiana. I've been to Indianapolis. I was a black person. I said, I think for years, that, hey, you can learn loads about white supremacy, racism, just learning what happened in your city, what happened in your state. Like, you can learn a lot just if you have offspring, just make little field trips to wherever you happen to be at. If they have any historical markers or museums or, well, I guess, you know, Rona permitting, once all that stuff opens back up. But I mean, yeah, you can do little field trips wherever you are, or even just go to the library. They probably have films, books, documentaries, all kinds of things where you can learn all kinds of information about white supremacy, racism, how it works at a local state level, and how it's operated probably for years, what this gentleman with this victim did in Indianapolis, Indiana. But I thought it was significant within that segment, he was talking about some of the black areas that had been destroyed by the construction of an interstate. And there have been so many reports talking about the willful obliteration of black businesses or black residential areas or both. With putting up these interstates. And I mean, they've had them in the LA Times, all over the country, LA Times, Florida. He was talking in Indianapolis, like everywhere. And they've even had projects that are kind of putting all these together in aggregate so you can view this in context. And again, this is another one, like, really? White people are ignorant about racism, but they seem to be able to flawlessly, even here in Seattle, construct interstates and highways that find wherever the Negros are trying to do something constructive, and whammo, we got to put an 8-lane highway right here. How is it that they managed to do that everywhere? Yes, that was even in the segment on Indianapolis, Indiana. And I think we should also have a program dealing with that later this month. It should be not this coming week, but a week from this Monday. I can give out the information later on, but one of our investors was hopeful that we could get some of the folks who put in one of the projects where they were kind of looking at all of this in aggregate, the deliberate, willful destruction of black residential and business areas when white people decide we got to put a highway right here through Negroville. That should be coming on the cows. White guests only. White guests only. Last thing I'll get in before we get to the callers. We heard the segment where they were talking about doing away with red meat, And I guess some white people being upset about that. I know the beef industry, white people who dominate that, will be furious about all of that. For a plant-based Gus tea, I think it would definitely be a healthier move for many, many non-white people to consume more vegetables, and especially to get away from a lot of the nonsense red meat and just eating fast food, burgers, and all the rest that is absolutely horrible for your health and well-being, especially over a long-term basis. I think I had mentioned, speaking of getting rid of red meat, I had just mentioned Sloppy Joe's, which I had not had in like forever. On, I believe, Thursday's broadcast, made them. They were normally traditionally made with red meat. I made them with lentils. They were amazing. I took pictures. I don't think I posted them. But I think this week I made amazing stuff on a pretty regular basis. And in fact, the Sloppy Joe's, I got the recipe. Judith Finlayson, she wrote, You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. I made a compensatory investment request. She has a vegetarian slow cooker cookbook. I made a compensatory investment request for that book. I got it just a few weeks back, and it took me some time to kind of go through and pick out recipes that I would like to make. And the first one I made was this week, the Sloppy Joe's, just because I was, you know, aghast. Like, Sloppy Joe's, I haven't seen these in forever. So I just wanted to try to see if I could make them and see what they would taste like. They were amazing. I'm right now, as we speak, making, she has a recipe for African peanut soup, which I've had before, which is pretty tasty. So I'm going to try out her recipe. But let's see, what else did I make this week? I made veggie lo mein, which was spectacular. I used to love vegetable lo mein, but I used to get it with red meat in it, or shrimp, or chicken, or all three. Made it with all vegetables. Whew. Sparkling. I made sesame cauliflower. I used to wolf down sesame chicken like by the bucket load, all that fried greasy chickenness. I made sesame cauliflower. Whew. Literally like lick the bowl good. And I think you might even be able to fool some meat eaters. It was so crispy and outstanding. Let's see, what else did I get to make this week? I made crispy tofu, coconut rice, chocolate chip cookies, and I made pecan sweet potato pie. Absolutely absurd. I don't even know if they make a dairy version of sweet potato pecan pie, like both of them together. So you have one layer is sweet potato and the layer that's on top is pecan. Whew. I don't know who the folks are like, oh my gosh, I'll miss out and you'll just be eating terrible food all the time and can't get desserts and can't get good foods. Like, psh, sweet potato pecan pie with whipped cream. I think there are pictures of that on my Facebook page. If you check it out, the sweet potato pecan pie, there are pictures of that. I think there are pictures. I didn't post the Sloppy Joe's. I have to post the Sloppy Joe's so that just so that people can see. Yes, they did exist and they were amazing. And I think some of the other food that I cooked this week got posted as well. But lots of amazing baking from Gusty, all plant based. So healthy, so important. I was thinking about that. So many black people end up having a lot of health problems just because we have been poisoned with horrible food for decades, just like they destroy with the highways and interstates, deliberately destroy so that black people have horrible access to food and then all the consequent health problems. So then they can sit around and, oh my gosh, the Negroes have terrible credit and terrible health and all the rest of it. And we don't want them living here. Yeah, why don't you go over there? We don't want them in our schools. That doesn't make me a racist either. Damn it. Yeah. Eat more veggies. Talk to your children about racism and sex abuse. With that, if we could not use metaphors for this broadcast, we don't need any kindling, wildfires, red flags, race soldiers. They will deliberately use metaphors and these little cliches, so-called figures of speech, to practice deception. They will take two separate entities and insist that they are identical, twins, exactly alike. Frequently, as I said, this is master deception. Victims, Gusty included, we've been exposed to this misconduct for decades. For many of us, we're still learning. Sometimes we don't have the logic to articulate our views, so we'll substitute some sort of cliche or metaphor. Often that just adds a lot more confusion to the conversation. I will prompt about the metaphors. One other thing, I would encourage folks, just be alert when you hear a conversation where there's more emotion, maybe less logic, but definitely more emotion, there will be a correlation for a higher amount of cliches, metaphors, analogies. That's just been something, an observation of mine, might mean nothing at all, but it could mean more emotion, less logic. People are being less critical about what they say. So there'll be a greater reliance on phrases where I don't have to process what I want to say. I'll just grab a phrase that's already been formulated for me and insert here to speak. I could be in error. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, that would be great. If you have additional thoughts, just make sure everyone gets at least one chance to share, and then you can return for additional thoughts or questions. Also, if you know you are in a loud environment, if you could please use your mute button just so that we can minimize the amount of unnecessary distractions and what have you that we have in the broadcast. Much obliged. Folks who have thoughts, observations, questions, maybe some constructive thoughts on what we heard from the news segments. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Ari.
Hotep, everyone. Hotep, Gus. I'm going to really try to make this fast. I've been doing a little bit of research on some of the things that I heard in the archive. When you mentioned the young man, Cornelius, God rest his soul, that died, I thought it was another young man that I heard about years ago. But this young man died the same way. He threw something. I think it may have been either food or small electronic object, and then he was held down and incapacitated to death by a foster care staff. Mind you, I reported on either workplace racism or something that I had witnessed some people. Maybe I didn't. Well, the same time that I witnessed the white individuals misgendering a black male with female clothes and hair items, that same day they grabbed up a 13-year-old girl because she had gotten frustrated in class and basically was saying, I need a break. And I asked the people, I was like, do you have a timeout room? And they ignored me, and promptly the people that do the restraint came in and just wrestled her up underneath her arms, one person on the both sides, and threw her against the wall. And then I decided to call Child Protection, and I didn't call anonymously. I don't know what happened to that case. They haven't called me back or anything, so I'm thinking they probably found it to be unfounded, probably because it's, you know, the state. Anyhow. But yeah, this has happened before. But the information that I got accidentally was that the man that started Sequel or whatever the name of the company is, I can't remember exactly, his name is Mark S. Mastroff. And he started his business ventures with opening 24-hour fitness. My question is, what does a person that has an interest or a background in fitness, what do you know about foster care? So I'll move on from that. I also want to share this, and I kind of named my notes today, sobriety is best. And I'll start with this. It's really not a joke. I'll say this again. I shared it a little bit. My son was hospitalized 3 times last year because of his encounters with cannabis. We don't know what kind of cannabis it was, whether it was medicinal, concentrate, flower, vapor. We don't know. We just know that he literally went psychotic. And when people say psychotic, it doesn't mean that a person wants to kill you. It just means they are so manic and they'll do things repeatedly and they'll obsess over things. They'll get loud. They don't have any bearing of their surroundings, and they'll say things that doesn't make sense. It's not necessarily violent. He ripped pages off of books, out of books. We had to, unfortunately, we had to get the police involved because he ran away. So please make sure that you're going through your kid's phone and that you know everything about him, because I guess I got a little lax or something, or was caught up in something and I slipped up, and he literally lost his mind 3 times, and the other times he was in the hospital was residual. We didn't expect him to have to be hospitalized again. You know, we didn't know we were going to get him back. The next part about why I mentioned sobriety is best is there's a documentary, Gus, I know you'd be highly interested in, because it features some commentary from Norm Stamper, and it's called Soaked in Bleach. I found out about this listening to Champagne Sharks, but when he mentioned it, I was like, okay, let me check this out. You can watch it on YouTube for free. And if you can, you know, tolerate the German or the Dutch, whatever it is, that's how it's free on YouTube. They have the little commentary in between in some Scandinavian language. But in this documentary, you're going to end up wondering whether the Seattle police was complicit in a murder of Kurt Cobain. And I said, this is fascinating, because this was Kurt Cobain and one of the most famous young white men at his time, during his time. If you all will either dismissively categorize his death as a suicide without proper investigation, what in the world do you do for non-white people who have died under suspicious circumstances? And I'll end with saying this. The reason why I named my note sobriety is best, like what you said, because the private investigator said this, and I'll never forget it. He said, if you want to get away with murder, kill a junkie. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, everyone.
Much obliged, Irie. That is, that's terrible about your offspring. Like that, I said that all the time. I don't have children, you know. That is a really, really tough job. Like, man, this, I don't even view, at least in my view, as someone who gets a total F at parenting, because I haven't even started. I don't even think it's you, you know, slipping or not, you know, being on top of your game in terms of attempted parenting. I just think, man, it's in a system of white supremacy, you cannot be omnipresent. You know, I mean, once they're past about 2 days old, you know, they can move around a little bit, they can roll. I mean, you can't be with them every second and what have you. You just try to do the best job that you can, especially once they're old enough to make decisions for themselves and what have you. Just try to do the best job that you can. And as Dr. Welsing, she talked about that, like, that was why that was included today. She talked about that in depth on the cows repeatedly with the cannabis. Like, hey, who knows what's in it? Like, you didn't grow it. You know, if we're talking about, as she was saying, Irie was saying, like, you know, she wasn't sure if he had concentrates or flour or, you know, what it is. The end result, we know, was not constructive. I mean, can you imagine you have to end up getting enforcement officers involved? Like, oh my gosh. Like, man, sobriety would be best. And talking about reports, I would probably end up showing my child a lot of those reports, Renisha McBride, because a whole lot of times with younger black people where they end up with problems, alcohol, these narcotics were involved in there some kind of way. Like it's not just that we're trying to be a killjoy and you can't have fun and all the rest of that. It's, oh, no. It's just, number one, your brain hasn't really developed yet, so you don't make great decisions. You're not supposed to. Your brain is still forming. And with these mind-altering substances, and we don't know what's in them, high likelihood that bad things can happen, even with a lot of so-called adults who have completely formed brain computers. You still end up with a lot of bad things happen. So, yeah, just try as best you can. But, I mean, hey, that is a tough job. I'm just glad that, as you said, just being able to get your child back and can process through this. Hopefully he can, you know, learn to say, man, nothing is more important than my health. I'm going to be more careful in the future. As for Mr. Kurt Cobain, we talked about that in the book just mentioned before, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. John Patash gets lots of plugs this week on the Cows. So that was the second time he was a guest on the program. And Kurt Cobain is one of the folks who is on the front of the book. And when he was with us in 2015, might have been 2016, but I think 2015 when he was a guest with us, either way, second time, we talked about drugs as weapons against us. We talked about Kurt Cobain specifically, even though he talks about lots of people. We talked about him specifically. How could we not? I'm in Seattle. Got to talk about him. And he said specifically, Kurt Cobain might have been drifting into talking a little bit about racism, white supremacy. Now, you know, hey, I'm not going to jump up and down about Jane Elliott, Timothy Wise, or any other white person who said a word or sentence about racism, but that was included, that he also might have been drifting into some speaking against racism, and they are not interested in hearing that. Incidentally, you don't really hear that. Nirvana is mentioned all the time in these parts, but you do not hear him associated with counter-racism. Like, you didn't hear people quoting Nirvana in the George Floyd protests over the past year around these parts. At least I don't remember that. Anyway, let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, questions, let's see. Line should be open. Proceed.
Oh, greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I have a couple of notes to share. The white people cannot experience racism, but the white woman and all the white parents who are being racist towards the black school people, they could definitely have a person who does not understand racism and white supremacy very much deceived. And I really appreciated your reporting on that. Was very pleasant to hear communicated so much. And I also made a comment on how they said that he should go to a poor community of color and make a change and be the change there. Very, very, very racist. The 25 9 white people executed, and the police raid, the race, I don't even know what to call it, and the law enforcement raid. And I heard that someone described that as a war scene, and I thought that was a very accurate description. Race and white supremacy is a war being waged against non-white people, and 25 people being executed, faced down like that, is definitely things that happen in a war. Another thing that I thought was interesting about these segments is that in a lot of places in the world, France and I forget the other places that were mentioned, people are demanding justice, and they want justice, and they're in the streets for justice. And I hope those people find like the code's definition of justice. And I hope they are able to find all the information that they need to do what needs to be done. And yeah, thanks for the show. Really constructive. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. I'm trying to see where Rockwood is in Missouri, just so I can be more informed. The Rockwood School District is in Eureka. So this is in St. Louis County. So as I said, this is very close to... so funny. The Rockwood teachers have asked for harassment protection over the racial inclusion curriculum. That's how bad things. But yeah, this is very, very close to Ferguson, Michael Brown Jr., and all of that. Very embarrassing all the way. And the system of racism, white supremacy is war. So frequently, many parts of the world will directly look like a war zone, especially if there are dark people there. The caller... Much obliged, caller in California. The caller at 2262. We heard you simultaneously. Did you have commentary? You should be with us also.
Yes, sir. Greetings, everyone. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus. I wanted to start off by saying thank you, Gus, for give me some of your advice on dealing with losses in the family. That I really appreciate that. Thank you. An update, I just learned today that two more relatives have passed. These relatives were in their like 50s and 60s, and they passed due to complications with COVID-19. So another day on the plantation. The segment about the white woman who was crying, telling the truth who was crying about just wanting to tell the truth about, you know, history and I guess critical race studies. I took that as her crying. I took that as an act of racist aggression. She also used the word love, and I noticed that she did not define what that word even means when you put it into practice. I thought that was interesting. The segment about the sexual misconduct, I was thinking that white people should just investigate all the organizations that have young people associated with them. And I suspect that they'll find all types of sexual misconduct. And they can also make several movies about them, like Spotlight. Speaking of movies, me and my attempted spouse are going to watch the documentary called Buck Breaking that talks about, sexual misconduct with non-white people. That should be interesting. The segment about the housing issue, white people can find all type of excuses to blame black people for our circumstances. I'm not sure the person speaking was white or non-white, but if she was white, I believe she was practicing racism when she claimed that white people, when they see black people in our dire straits, don't know how they got there, you know, or why they're in their circumstances. I believe if she was white, she was practicing racism by making that kind of statement. I believe there's a segment about a non-white person who was targeted by a white person for, I guess, dating their girlfriend or something to that effect. I'll just say to that, no sex with white people. The segment about Brazil, I was thinking if Jair Bolsonaro wants to deal with the drugs in the country, how about he provide the citizens with well-paying jobs and adequate housing and adequate health care if he really wants to deal with the drug issue. And for now, that'll be it. Thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Bit sobering. My condolences to you and your family for your loss. I guess did you have any reason to suspect that, you know, this might have been something other than COVID-19, that they might have just been saying that this is COVID-19 and it might have been, you know, something else that caused the passing of your relatives?
I was told through another relative that they had passed due to complications with COVID-19, but they were not, in my opinion, they were not in the best of health. I think the spouse to one of my relatives who passed before his attempted wife, he was in a wheelchair prior to being committed to the hospital for his COVID-19 diagnosis.
Take your health very seriously. That right there, the system of white supremacy is designed to erode, compromise the health and vitality of non-white people, black people especially. We will need vitality if we are going to solve this problem, our cosmic assignment. So, man, as best you can, really value your health. I don't, you know, when I have the segment that we ended with, talking about, you know, not eating as much meat, eating more plant-based products, and talking about, you know, make these lentil sloppy joes, and the pecan sweet potato pie was a half a cup of brown sugar away from being totally sugarless and dairy-free. Still delicious. But I don't mention that stuff. And then the yoga retreats that we've had, all plant-based meals, that's not just, you know, to brag, like, oh man, we had, you know, all the cuisine. It's all of that is the protest. Eating well, taking care of yourself so that Mr. Fuller in his 90s and not, you know, feeble and can't understand things, like still writing, active, cognitive. That's what you want, to be healthy and active for, you know, a long, long time, and not to be struggling and, you know, having people that are in poor health already in their 30s and 40s, because that's what the system of white supremacy intends for non-white people. So, again, it's very much anchored in, hey, these are things making, preserving and prioritizing our health, making that very, very important in things that we do on a regular basis. Primarily, what is on our fork, drinking as much water as we can on a regular basis. But yeah, man, my condolences to you and your family. That is horrendous in a horrendous year. I hope you all are doing as much as you can to nourish, to have so much grief all at one time. Like, man, that is just an assault on mental health. I hope you're doing lots to nourish, getting lots of rest, just trying to take care of each other as best you can. Condolences from me and rest of the Cows listeners. Wow. I guess bravo for doing constructive viewing with your attempted partner. That sounds nourishing. Constructive sources. I guess so folks don't get carried away. We do not do entertainment for the compensatory call-in. People get very excited often about what they've seen on Netflix. We did get some quality documentaries, so take that. But we do not do entertainment for the compensatory call-in. Spotlight isn't necessarily a documentary, although that is very constructive. Recommended that one myself. Let's see. Much obliged, folks that we've heard thus far. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Not be hurt.
Greetings, Henry, in Chicago.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The segment of the lifeguard sex scandal in Chicago, I was listening to some of the name of the beaches that they had mentioned about these reports of this scandal. And obviously, these were beaches that were on the north side of Chicago, where predominantly white people live. So that's no surprise. And speaking of Chicago, there's been a situation that's been going on here for the last couple of years that deals with environmental racism. There's a company called General Iron who has a factory on the north side of Chicago, predominantly white area, where they're trying to move their car crushing factory to the far south side of Chicago. Now, for those who have joined us in the book club and have read Packing Them In and A Terrible Thing to Waste in regards to environmental terrorism, most people know that the Outgale Gardens, which is a housing project here in Chicago, is surrounded by many landfills. And it is one of the most polluted areas, not just in Chicago, but possibly in the whole country. And so this was a topic that was discussed in the books that, you know, we had reviewed in the book club as well. So they're moving, they're trying to move the facility from an all-white neighborhood, which many people had complained about, to the predominantly black area on the south side, where they already have landfills and industries that, you know, release pollutants in those particular areas. However, the new EPA person within the Biden administration had contacted Mayor Lori Lightfoot about suspending their license to move because of the fact that this is what they have deemed as environmental injustice. I remember when we were reading Packing Them In, so Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington had appropriately said environmental racism, which is the more appropriate way to review that. So this is something that we are all keeping an eye on here in Chicago in regards to that. You mentioned a lot of the stories in L.A. that intertwine with each other, the Rodney King case, O.J. Simpson, the death of Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G., and then also the Rampart case. But I was thinking also, too, that may connect in this and is the Dark Alliance, story that was released in the 90s by white man named Gary Webb, who wrote about the CIA's involvement in distributing crack cocaine in the particularly black areas in Los Angeles, which started which made the drug dealer Freeway Ricky Ross, non-white black man, famous. And many people had finally realized that it was white people that was giving him drugs to distribute. So as we all know, and as we all known for a while, that drugs are not grown in black areas, and the only people that are capable of giving or putting drugs in the community is white people. So I think that that was very important as well. And in regards to Sloppy Joe, Dr. Ruby Lason on her website has the recipe for vegan Sloppy Joe, and I actually made some from that. And actually, my wife, who is not a vegan, said that she enjoyed it. So Dr. Ruby Lathan also, who's also been on the Cows as well, has the recipe for vegan Sloppy Joe. But that's all I have on my mind.
Love Dr. Ruby. Just saw her yesterday. She should be coming back to get us some more recipes and what have you. You can visit her website, RubyLathan.com.
Delicious.com. Just make it delicious. I keep saying that. Just make it delicious. As long as it tastes good, it really doesn't matter if it's vegan or not vegan. People are not vegan or what have you. As long as you make it so that it tastes good, people will, wow, that is awesome. And it's vegan? Oh, my goodness. That's the most amazing thing ever. But, yeah, I'm trying to, oh, I see them. I said, now, they look similar. Hers look very similar to mine. She made hers with tempeh. I made mine with lentils. I'm going to, let's see. Does she have the recipe? Okay, yeah, I'm looking at her recipe. Yep, see, she made hers with tempeh. I made mine with lentils. That's about the only difference. I used ketchup. She used tomato paste. Other than that, very, and I used celery. Lots of, that was, I was very suspicious. Like, this is not going to be Sloppy Joe. I don't know what this is going to be, but not Sloppy Joe. But 6 hours in the slow cooker, the celery totally disappeared, and it looked very similar. In fact, I garnished it the same way. I had spinach on the bun, some fresh tomato. I had vegan butter, so I had nice toasted bun. But, oh, I've not had Sloppy Joe's in a long time, but they were amazing. Woof! Eat well, eat well. I have to pay attention from the book club. I think they even mentioned Altgeld Gardens in President Obama's Dreams from My Father. I have to go back to double check, but that one's, you know, much further back in the book club. But I definitely know it's in the two he mentioned. It might even be a third time. Lots of people for years and years and years have talked about the environmental terrorism that black people in the south side of Chicago have endured for decades. And I'm not surprised. In fact, I could see the logic of it being, they've already got so many dumps and wastelands over there. What's the big deal? You know, we put one or three more. What's the big deal? In Dark Alliance, absolutely. I know Dr. Kamau Kamban highly recommended that folks check that book out. Los Angeles being a very important hub in trafficking of narcotics and illegal substances. Sobriety would be best. That's such a big part of what was happening at that time period as well. And I think some of that comes up in Labyrinth and some of the other works in terms of the COINTELPRO operations using the Bloods, Crips, some of these other so-called gangs in their distribution lines in Los Angeles. Even I think some of that coming out in relationship to some of these assassinations with Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G., the Rampart scandal, the drug trafficking LAPD members. Like, absolutely. Dark Alliance, Gary Webb, reading way more important than watching television. In fact, I'd be willing to bet a shiny nickel John Potash probably references Dark Alliance in Drugs as Weapons Against Us and or the FBI's war against Tupac Shakur and black leaders. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed. While folks are, I guess, getting their thoughts together, we should be here for the book club on Thursday, which has proved to be Memory Lane, John Potash, M. Wesley Swearingen, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, a number of folks that we've had as guests on the COWS over the years, and talking about Geronimo Pratt, COINTELPRO in general. I think pretty much Geronimo Pratt each time, though. But we are continuing with the book club, as related very much to many other prominent things that happened in the city of Los Angeles in recent history. We're continuing with that. I actually had a vegan filmmaker contact me about being a guest on the program. I think they're classified as white. I'm generally leery when people reach out to me about being a guest on the program. But since these individuals are classified as white, I said, hey, I need to make sure I verify that. But I mean, if that is the case, maybe we can see if we can learn some things. And then we can also question aggressively, since they are requesting an opportunity to chat it up and take space on the context of white supremacy. So we will see about the vegan filmmakers, what exactly they want to chat about. And then we should have the white people talking about the deliberate destruction of black residential areas and businesses coming up, not this Monday, but the beginning of next week. Let's see. Folks still spectating or needing a little bit more time to get their thoughts together?
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas? Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Thank you. Greetings, listeners and callers. Again, thank you for the program. A couple of things. To the caller who suffered the loss of his relatives, I prefer not to use the term, you know, sorry for your loss, anything like that. If you loved those people, if you care for those people that transitioned, find some sense of peace, understanding that they can't, you know, knowingly be victimized by this system that we're in. The segment, I wish I could take notes, I couldn't, but the segment about, I believe it was the housing, and it was either housing or education, and how the Supreme Court had ruled against whatever practices in, you know, 1940-something, and then ruled again, so you still can't do it in 1960-something, and somehow, you know, this racist act, I believe it was redlining, or miseducation of children, either one, pick one, you know, it keeps occurring, you know, the speaker said, you know, you can't erase the legacy. I thought that was very interesting, and I might not be quoting her verbatim, but it was something to that effect. And I thought that statement would be simpler to just say, you know, racists are going to be racist. it just makes sense, you know. We can do it, yeah, and we will do it. I also found it very interesting and entertaining the critical race crier. It's amazing how certain things like critical race theory can get stopped and meetings be held and, you know, people crying, things are heard. And that can happen. And when it comes to, you know, teaching your children about skin color, you know, I guess what people define as skin color and how they're treated based on it. And like that can be halted. You know, we need meetings for that. But we're going to teach our children, your children, about sex, whether you like it or not. And all kinds of sex, wrong sex, weird, you know, just, and if you say something about it, something's wrong with you. But she gets to cry because she thinks she's not a racist. She thinks she's not. I thought that was very interesting. And I wouldn't be surprised if these people, since it's something that they don't want, that they actually see results. Like fake or be those real or fake tears, like she's going to get results, in my opinion. Thank you. I mute my line.
Oh, they're going to get results. You bet the farm, as the metaphor says, like, have no fear. They will be victorious. There will be no critical race theory in Rockwood. absolutely not. They white people can be extremely effective when they get serious. They are not serious about ending the system practice of white supremacy racism. Only logical conclusion that one can come to, because anything else that they get serious about, oh man, the meetings happen and things get done, generally in a very prompt manner. Things.
They find money.
Hey. Resources become available. If it has to be a bake sale or raffle, whatever it is, like, resources become available, things begin to happen. It is not magic. It's not by accident. It is when white people get serious, especially the most powerful white people, when they get serious about doing things, things happen.
Hello, can I say something if nobody else new comes on the line?
I reckon so. Irie.
Okay, yeah, well, before I listened to the archive with Dr. Gerald Horn, who I listen to frequently on Black Agenda Report, I saw a short documentary made by a gentleman on YouTube. He goes by John G. Horst. And he was talking about Step and Fetch It. So for some reason, there has been a play made about how the gentleman that portrayed the role of Step and Fetch It, and I'm sorry, I can't recall his name, Victim of Racism. According to this play and according to some type of folklore history, I don't know if it's true or not, he supposedly taught Jack Johnson's punch to Muhammad Ali, and forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, but I know he taught a punch to Muhammad Ali, and I do believe it was Jack Johnson, or it could be some other person, but the white people were absolutely enthralled by it. And then with the lady at the school board meeting, I was waiting for her to just stand back and cry out, Stella! You know, because it was just dramatic and, you know, a distraction, the emotional distraction and diversion away from what she is, a suspected racist, you know. And the gentleman's right. They teach the sexual confusion without hesitation. And if you have a problem, you can get in trouble for it as a faculty member or a parent. So I'm in my line.
Lots of conversation before conception about what is our offspring's academic plan going to look like. Like, we want to minimize the sexual confusion. If there's going to be critical race theory, we'll decide what that looks like. Those type conversations way before we get to the bedroom. That is the best way to proceed. If not, racists, they have already been working on a plan for your child who has not yet been conceived, and all the things they're going to do to him or her, all the ill things that they will teach her or him. Mother's Day tomorrow. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks, commentary they wanted to get in. We have less than 30 minutes left in the broadcast. If you have commentary thoughts to share, proceed. While folks are getting their thoughts together and or spectating, we had a listener who wrote in. I guess if folks, Cal's listeners specifically, if people, since we were talking about health and the importance of maintaining your health, getting some exercise in, not being sedentary in the midst of, you know, all of this, if you're spending more time at home. In fact, I read that. Speaking of Dr. Ruby, we did our Friday morning yoga class. They had a report in the Wall Street Journal, and they were talking about how a number of physicians have reported lots of people like a substantial increase reporting back pain, hip pain, all this discomfort in their neck. And their analysis is that people have been doing so much sitting around over the past year plus now, and then having to kind of piece together some sort of workstation in their residence might not be the best sitting arrangement, that all of that is really bad on your posture. And they had all these recommendations, but kept being emphasized not being sedentary, not doing a lot of sitting around, get up, stretch, move your body. They even had the audacity to mention yoga and different specific yoga postures, which is why I read it yesterday as we ended class. But just they really emphasized if you've been doing a lot of sitting around. They didn't get any part of, you know, eating, weight gain, or any of that, the other COVID-19, but just sitting around, really bad for your body, bad for your health, bad for your immune system. Just being in the house, they emphasize making sure for optimal health, your body's supposed to be moving around and dynamic, and you don't get to sit, you have to do things. 10,000 steps a day, optimal health. That's why I said try to get outside. It's getting warmer, even way up north here in Seattle, it is getting warmer. Been loving it, been posting my pictures out at the beach and checking out the ducks and all that, geese. Get outside, get some activity, get some of that sunshine. That is so good for your health and well-being, especially if you have been cooped up inside for the winter months and even the early part of spring if it's still cold. They had pictures for some folks, it was snowing even in April and such. So if it's warm enough, if you can get outside, maybe still have a jacket or sweater with you, but get out there. That is so much better for your body and your health. 10,000 steps per day. That is the recommendation. I know lots of folks are doing their Uber and driving around and all the rest of it, but 10,000 steps a day, very, very important for the health of your body, health and vitality, to be active and moving, not just, you know, sitting around in that chair on the sofa, Netflix and surfing the web. Any other folks thoughts they want to make sure they get in, commentary, suggestions?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you again, Gus. I'd like to say thank you to Mo in Dallas for his kind words. Thank you for that. I wanted to go back to the town hall meeting or a school meeting with the white woman. She said, well, I'm not sure what she said, but it was stated that they didn't want to hear about black main characters in the school. Was that right, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Oh. It's interesting that in the year 2021, we can't hear about black main characters, but for the last hundreds of years, we hear about white main characters. And that's all. I'm in my line.
See, I said I would have to see the list. Like, what books do they have in this school? Like, are they reading Malcolm X? Are they reading The Hate U Give? Like, what are they reading where they are grousing and complaining about main black characters? Are they reading, you know, The Life and Times of Nat Turner? Like, what's on the list? Let me see it, and then, you know, I can comment yay or nay about, you know, that. But yes, that stood out as many things that were said in that segment about the Rockwood school system. Yes, that also stood out as well. Oh yes, I mentioned all that with yoga to say hopefully we'll have Dr. Ruby on so she can talk about recipes and exercise and all of that in the midst of all this, and hopefully doing better to take care of our health for black people. But also, if folks would be interested in doing yoga, they were saying, hey, Gus, you could teach a yoga session. If folks might be interested, that could help, you know, with getting a little bit of exercise, helping with not being sedentary, move around a little bit, help them maybe even break a sweat. That is so good. Break a little bit of a sweat. And use their muscles a little bit. I said, I guess let me know. There's so much of that. I guess people are trying to get back to going to the gym and other things right now. But I guess you could drop me a line if folks would be interested in doing some sort of online yoga, like a, I don't know, once a week type of a thing. If folks are interested, let me know. I guess they were, I don't know, it was said yoga. I don't know if they meant like a more active, like vinyasa, break a sweat type flow, or a more calm, yin, quiet, like get ready for bed type of a thing. But I definitely know the active, that would be always good to break a sweat, build some heat, tapas, as they say. But let me know, untiljustice@gmail.com, if folks would be interested in doing a little yoga with Gus T. Let's see. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Hopefully, I'll be able to brag quite a bit about different things that I've cooked this year. They have the Seattle Vegan Fest, or Veggie Fest, excuse me. It's every autumn. I think they've had it running here for like decades now. I've been here for the longest and have never been. I'm going to try to go this year unless the Rona squashes the event. But they're supposed to have all kinds of recipes and different things you can try out. So I'm excited for the Veggie Fest. There is no reason that you have to have bland mealtime just because you're eating healthy and ditching the meat products. You can have spectacular meals. Sweet potato pie. Has anybody had sweet potato pecan pie? That's what I thought. That's what I thought. You don't even know what you're missing out on. Like, whew, having them both together at the same time, it is absolutely decadent. But plant-based can be super healthy, super delicious. No compromising on either. Let's see. Any other folks commentary they want to make sure they get in?
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with there was the segment where I think they were talking about the social media, and I believe in the area that's called Europe, I believe, or where they talk about the soccer or football. Games where they were saying that the coaches, the fans, somewhat had this mentality that the athletes are, I guess, subjugated to their position of being white. You know, like they're supposed to entertain them, and using the monkey emojis. I've seen some white people do that. A lot of racism going on there. And it seems like that's been going on for a good while. I forgot the black male's name. I think it was Mario something. I can't remember his last name. And they did the conflating where they started mentioning women. And it looks like they were trying to do comparisons, but it's like I can guarantee that there were white women doing things like, from what I remember, throwing banana peels, I believe, on the field, like all kinds of things with racist implications. And it is continuously widespread and everything. And as far as the restrictions and covenants, that word definitely sounds familiar. When people are requesting copies, and some of these restrictions can go from 15 pages, 80 pages, depending on the subdivision. But, and those, as I shared, those ones from the 1920s, 30s and 40s, they have, this property must be exclusively reserved for the Caucasian race or the white race. You know, like the wording definitely is displayed in that manner. And there was something else going on earlier this week with, I think, the voting restriction or the voter suppression with the governor, Santis. That was going on, and there was something about a black female stepping down from the equal opportunity position, and they said the city commissioners were trying to get her to stay in that position. So I don't know what that's about necessarily. And I just wanted to say thanks for the program and another great series of audio segments. And thanks, everyone. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I did see that about the voting changes in Florida. I think they were, Ron DeSantis was trying to make it a little bit more difficult. Oh, they were changing. It was one, they wanted to change about the voting boxes. I don't know the technical name, but the places where you can drop your ballot at, that's sitting outside. And we said, oh my gosh, you've got to have security. This is, you know, absurd. Just have them unguarded and just sitting outside all the time unguarded, and they'll just allow any type of hooligans to do what they want. Drop boxes, that's what they call them, drop boxes. They said they wanted to change those up and some other things. It seemed like it would make it a little bit more challenging for people to vote. They have all kinds of things happening in Florida. That Ron DeSantis has been busy, could be presidential candidate sometime in the future. The emojis, when they were talking about the racism with regards to European soccer, and putting the monkeys up, I totally forgot I was going to put the monkey sound effects in, and I just forgot, was reminded when I heard the clip play back. And then they used the metaphor. They said when white people are doing this, when they see athletes, and I don't think they relegated it to just European soccer, they were saying when really any of these white spectators, when they're seeing white male and or white female spectators, when they're seeing these athletes, Mario Balotelli or whoever, because they mentioned LeBron James, whomever, Floyd Mayweather, insert Serena Williams, insert name of, you know, the Negro athlete, when they're doing these things, whether they're winning, like they're doing well, or they're losing, either way, monkey emoji. And they said that was like their virtual whip. Talk about metaphor. Which, I mean, plantation, that's why I don't ever say Seattle is the best city. Plantation. That was what the metaphor that was used in the segment. That was their nigger has gotten out of line, or, you know, nigger is doing too well. Get online and put our emojis or call them a nigger or whatever it is. Again, what does it mean to be white anywhere in the world? You cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and be classified as white. None of what they described in that segment sounded like ignorance. Incidentally, several folks, I think, talked about the segment where they were referencing the housing covenants and what have you. Colin Florida just talked about that, and he has, on neutralizing workplace racism, discussed folks come to the Florida courthouse to do archival research on all the restrictions and racist covenants. No Negroes allowed in this part of Florida. No Negroes allowed here. No chinks allowed here, and all the rest of it. In that segment, I believe the guest was a non-white person, because I looked up her name and material immediately, non-white person. And I'm always appalled and disgusted. They'll have a white person on who will pretend that they don't know this information and then have a black person to explain. And I'm just that's like, it's a lengthy list about why. Context of white supremacy, white guests only. But that's having it the other way around is just abysmal every time out. And it just gets to reinforce this. White people are ignorant. We need someone non-white to explain this information to us. Why don't we have the chick that came down to the courthouse and was getting the records? Let's have her get on NPR and explain what your project is doing and how this relates to the system of white supremacy, at least locally in Florida. Sunshine State, as they say. I'd much rather have it be that way than I don't care how informed she is. She could have 15 PhDs, and I've been studying this for 50 years. That's great. Whoopee. Let me get that white woman who came down to the courthouse, and that's what she does. Let me get her and break it down for us. Much obliged, caller in Florida. Let's see. Other folks commentary that they want to make sure they get in. Let's see. I can share my moment of confusion. I watched where I was looking at the BBC this week, and they had the report of Bill Gates and Melinda Gates. I guess they're getting a divorce. That was this week. Lots of things happened this week, as is normally the case. But the BBC, the photograph that they had, at least to me, when I first glanced at it, it looked like it was Bill Gates and Caitlyn Jenner. I was like, oh my gosh, are they dating? Like, I was stunned. And then I kind of was like, oh, okay, that's Melinda. I'm like, well, okay, it's a bad picture. They got a different one. Like, whew. I guess I've been seeing Caitlyn Jenner in the news. Apparently she's running for governor, or I guess is thinking about maybe running for governor of California. She could easily win. Arnold Schwarzenegger won before, Ronald Reagan before. She could easily win. But that was my one moment of, whoa, let me be careful and make sure I'm looking at things. Talking about sexual confusion, my goodness. Gotta read carefully things. Let's see. Any other commentary folks want to make sure they get in, or folks satisfied? Assume folks might be good for their week. I was trying to find the Florida. Did I miss someone? Or maybe not. I was trying to find the Florida official who stepped down, and I couldn't get the name. So maybe I'll check, see if I can find any additional information, track that person down. Is anybody doing any celebration for so-called Mother's Day tomorrow? I did see where some folks, they said, hey, we did not do anything last year. It's been a whole year, and we stayed away from folks who were quarantining. Now folks are vaccinated and moving out. Are folks celebrating, or are folks being codified? It's still no holidays. System of white supremacy has not been replaced, so no holidays. Are people actually going to try and do anything constructive for their attempted mom tomorrow? Make that our last one before we sign out. Maybe nothing. I guess they'll think on it and let us know down the road, perhaps. Either way, we will be here for the book club at minimum on Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm going to have to check it out with the vegan filmmakers to pick a date and time. But once we get solidified, like, I will post their materials so people can be like, I'm not sure if the film has been like released, but we can all be extra studied, extra prepared, so that we can ask all kinds of questions. These are white people, so hey, we should all take advantage. Question white people, the problem. If anything, eat well. I hope folks, I mentioned Judith Van Lassen's cookbook, which in use right now. I have my African peanut soup cooking as we speak. Make an effort. Use the compensatory investment request. I know Mr. Fuller has lots of recommendations. You don't have to agree with them all, but I would say at least try it. And particularly now, you have so many white people who are saying, yes, systemic racism is a problem. We need to address white privilege and diversity. Inclusion, compensatory investment request, and make it for something constructive. It might not even necessarily have to be for you, but try to see if you can think of something that would be good to request, and then a white person, bam, try it out. I am enjoying my cookbook, Sloppy Joe's African Peanut Soup, up next. Much obliged for folks who participated. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. I think we already have someone to do the reading. If we end up doing Elliot Rodger, his manifesto, if we end up doing that next. But I guess people can let me know if you participate in the book club. Labyrinth, that would kind of give us a trilogy for Los Angeles and would bring us right back to the same time period as O.J. Simpson to kind of re-examine the assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G. We still have a few weeks left with Geronimo Pratt's biography, but Labyrinth, I think it's Robert Sullivan. I have to double check, make sure that's the correct name, but I think Labyrinth might be a good one. Dark Alliance, Gary Webb also. LA is an excellent city to study the system of white supremacy racism for lots of reasons. Racial classification confusion, affirmative action down in California, the gang, so-called gang situation. Lots of great read. That's, I believe, Los Angeles Police Department. That is the birth of the SWAT team. Lots of great reasons to study the history of Los Angeles. So we'll keep that in mind for the book club. Anywho, much obliged. Was Mo from Dallas, did you have commentary to share or just listening in? Just listening. Right on. Much obliged for folks listening in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety, get to say it again. So thankful. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy for lots of reasons. Preserve your brain computer. Don't want to pick up any unnecessary habits. Don't want to bankroll white people for peddling poison. Lots of reasons. Let's be efficient about solving the problem, our cosmic assignment, replacing white supremacy with justice. In addition to being sober, if we're going to go out, be very alert. There are lots, particularly in the U.S., lots of armed, hostile whites. If you see someone and they're being rowdy, hostile, you do not want to be involved in verbal confrontations with strangers. You should be thinking this person, she, he may be armed. He, she may have a whole group of folks that I can't even see right now. They're also armed. They were prepared to ambush. I did not leave my residence ready to kill or die. As such, you should be looking to exit. Very dangerous times right now. Lots of people are not stable. They're on drugs, alcohol. They're newly armed, mad about the Rona situation. Take all of that into consideration when you venture out. Be very aware. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, we need all of our attention. And then two, we're trying to minimize contact with race soldiers, the Mark Furmans of the known universe. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.